And Scott is quite sure that his father is going to rush across the cellar to where his surviving son stands, with his tripled shadow racing beside him on the rock walls, and backhand him. Perhaps knock him spang into his big brother's dead lap. He's been backhanded plenty of times, and usually even the thought of it makes him cringe. But now he stands straight between Paul's splayed legs, looking into his father's eyes. It's hard to do that, but he manages, because they have survived a terrible passage together and will have to keep it between themselves forever. Shh. So he deserves to ask, and he deserves to look in Daddy's eyes while he waits for his answer. Daddy doesn't come at him. Instead, he takes a deep breath, blows it out, and turns around.
You'll be telling me when to wash the floors and scrub out the toilet next, I guess, he grumbles. I'll give you a count of 30, Scoot.
21. I'll give you a count of 30 and then I'm turning around again, Scott tells her. I'm pretty sure that's how he finished it, but I never heard because by then I was gone off the face of the earth. Paul, too, right out of his chains. I took him with me as easy as ever once he was dead. Maybe easier. I bet Daddy never finished counting to 30. Hell, I bet he never even got started before he heard the clink of chains or maybe the sound of air rushing in to fill the space where we'd been, and he turned around and he saw that he had the cellar all to himself. Scott has relaxed against her. The sweat on his face and arms and body is drying. He has told it, gotten the worst of it out of him, sicked it up. The sound, she says. I wondered about that, you know. If there was a sound under the willow tree when we, you know, came back out.
When we boomed.
Yes, when we, that.
When we boomed, Lisey, say it.
When we boomed.
Wondering if she's crazy. Wondering if he is. And if it's catching.
Now he does light another cigarette, and in the match glow his face is honestly curious.
What did you see, Lisey? Do you remember?
Doubtfully, she says, there was a lot of purple slanting down a hill, and I had a sense of shade, like there were trees right behind us, but it was also quick, no more than a second or two. He laughs and gives her a one-armed hug.
That Sweetheart Hill you're talking about.
Sweetheart?
Paul named it that.
There's dirt all around those trees, soft, deep. I don't think it's ever winter there, and that's where I buried him. That's where I buried my brother. He looks at her solemnly and says, do you want to go see, Lisey?
22.
Lisey had been asleep on the study floor in spite of the pain. No, she hadn't been asleep, because you couldn't sleep with pain like this, not without medical help. So what had she been? Mesmerized. She tried the word on for size and decided it fit just about perfectly. She had slid into a kind of doubled, maybe even trebled, recall. Total recall. But beyond this point, her memories of the cold guest room where she'd found him catatonic, and those of the two of them in the creaky second-floor bed at the Antlers, these memories 17 years older but even clearer, were blotted out.
Do you want to go see Lisey?
He had asked her.
Yes, yes.
But whatever had come next was drowned in brilliant purple light, hidden behind that curtain, and when she tried to reach for it, authority voices from childhood, good ma's, dandies, all her big sisters, clamored in alarm. No, Lisey, that's far enough, Lisey. Stop there, Lisey. Her breath caught. Had it caught as she lay there with her love? Her eyes opened. They had been wide as he took her in his arms, of that she was sure. Bright morning June light, 21st century June light, replacing the staring, glaring purple of a billion lupin. The pain of her lacerated breast flooded back in with that light. But before Lisey could react to either the light or the panicky voices commanding her to go no farther, someone called to her from the barn below, startling her so badly that she came within a thread of screaming. If the voice had stopped short at Mrs., she would have.
Mrs. Landon?
A brief pause.
Are you up there?
No trace of border south in that voice, only a flat Yankee drawl that turned the words into, are you up there? and Lisi knew who was down there, Deputy Alston. He told her he'd keep checking back, and here he was, as promised. This was her chance to tell him, hell yes, she was up here. She was lying on the floor bleeding because the Black Prince of the Inkunks had hurt her. Alston had to take her to Nosopa with the flashers and the siren going. She needed stitches in her breast, a lot of them, and she needed protection, needed it around the clock. No, Lisi. It was her own mind that sent the thought up. Of this she was positive. Like a flare into a dark sky. Well, almost positive. But it came to her in Scott's voice, as if it would gain authority that way. And it must have worked because... Yes, I'm here, deputy, was all she called back. Everything fine by? Okay, I mean. Five by, that's affirmative, she said, amazed to find she actually sounded five by five. Especially for a woman whose blouse was soaked in blood and whose left breast was throbbing like a... Well, there was really no accurate simile. It was just throbbing. Down below, at the very foot of the stairs, Lisi calculated, Deputy Alston laughed appreciatively. I just stopped on my way over to Cash Corners. They got a little house fire over there. Arson suspected. You'd be all right on your own for a couple 3 hours? Fine. Got your cell phone? She did indeed have her cell phone, and wished she were on it right now. If she had to keep shouting down at him, she was probably going to pass out. Right cheer, she called back. Oh yeah? A little dubious. God, what if he came up and saw her? He'd be plenty dubious then, dubious to the nth power. But when he spoke again, the voice was moving away. She could hardly believe she was glad, but she was. Now that this was begun, she wanted to finish it. Well, you call if you need anything, and I'll be checking back later on. If you go out, leave a note so I'll know you're all right, and when to expect you back, okay? And Lisi, who now began to see, vaguely, a course of events ahead of her, called back, Check! She'd have to begin by returning to the house. But first, before anything else, a drink of water. If she didn't get some more water, and soon, her throat might catch fire like that house over to Cash Corners. I'll be coming by Patel's on my way back, Mrs. Landon. Would you like me to pick anything up? Yes, a 6-pack of ice-cold Coke and a carton of Salem Lights. No thanks, deputy. If she had to talk much more, her voice would give out. Even if it didn't, he'd hear something wrong in it. Not even donuts? They have great donuts. A smile in his voice. Dieting. It was all she dared. Uh-oh, I heard that, he said. You have a nice day, Mrs. Landon. Please, God, no more, she prayed and called back. You too, deputy. Clump, clump, clumpity clump, and away he went. Lisi listened for the sound of an engine, and after a while she thought she heard one starting up, but very faint. He must have parked by her mailbox and then walked the length of the driveway. Lisi lay where she was a moment longer, gathering herself, then rose to a sitting position. Dooley had sliced diagonally across her breast and up toward the hollow of her armpit. The ragged, wandering gash had stiffened and closed up a little, but her movement tore it open again. The pain was enormous. Lisi cried out, and that made matters even worse. She felt fresh blood run down her ribcage. Those dark wings began to steal over her vision again, and she willed them away, repeating the same mantra over and over again until the world grew solid. I have to finish this. I have to get behind the purple. I have to finish this. I have to get behind the purple. I have to finish this and get behind the purple. Yes, behind the purple. On the hillside it had been Lupin. In her mind it was the heavy curtain she had constructed herself, maybe with Scott's help, certainly with his tacit approval. I've gotten behind it before. Had she? Yes. And I can do it again. Get behind it or rip the goddamn thing down if I have to. Question. Had she and Scott ever spoken of Booyah Moon again after that night at the Antlers? Lisi thought not. They had their code words, of course, and God knew those words had floated out of the purple on occasion when she'd been unable to find him in malls and grocery stores, not to mention the time that nurse misplaced him in his smucking hospital bed. And there was the muttering reference to his long boy when he'd been lying in the parking lot after Gerd Allen Cole had shot him. And Kentucky, Bowling Green, as he lay dying. "Stop, Lisi," the voices chorused. "You mustn't, little Lisi," they cried. "Mein Gott, you don't dare, Inzi." She had tried to put Buya Moon behind her, even after the winter of 96, when I went there again. Her voice was dry but clear in her dead husband's study. "In the winter of 1996, I went again. I went to bring him back." There it was, and the world did not end. Men in white coats did not materialize out of the walls to carry her away. In fact, she thought she even felt a little better, and maybe that wasn't so surprising. Maybe when you got right down to where the short hairs grew, truth was a bool, and all it wanted was to come out. "Okay, it's out now. Some of it, the Paul part. So can I get a smucking drink of water?" Nothing told her no, and using the edge of Dumbo's big jumbo as a support, Lisi managed to pull herself to her feet. The dark wings came again, but she hung her head over, trying to keep as much blood in her miserable excuse for her brain as possible, and this time the faintness passed more quickly. She set sail for the bar alcove, walking her own back trail of blood, taking slow steps with her feet wide apart, thinking she must look like an old lady whose walker had been stolen. She made it, sparing only a brief look for the glass lying on the carpet. She wanted nothing more to do with that one. She got another one out of the cabinet, once again using her right hand, the left was still clutching the bloody square of knitting, and drew cold water. Now the water was running again and the pipes barely chugged at all. She swung out the glass mirror over the basin, and inside was what she had been hoping for. A bottle of Scott's Excedrin. No childproof cap to slow her down either. She winced at the vinegary smell that wafted from the bottle after she popped the cap and checked the expiration date. July, 05. Oh well, she thought. A girl's gotta do what a girl's gotta do. "I think Shakespeare said that," she croaked, and swallowed three of the Excedrin. She didn't know how much good they would do her, but the water was heavenly, and she drank until her belly cramped. Lisi stood clutching the lip of her dead husband's bar sink, waiting for the cramp to pass. Finally it did. That left only the pain in her beaten-up face and the much deeper throbbing in her lacerated breast. In the house she had taken something much stronger than Scott's head bonkers, although certainly no fresher. Vicodin from Amanda's previous adventure in self-mutilation. Darla also had some, and Canty had Manda Bunny's bottle of Percocet. They had all agreed, without ever really even discussing it, that Amanda herself couldn't be allowed access to the hard stuff. She might get feeling yucky and decide to take everything at once. Call it a tequila sunset. Lisi would try for the house and the Vicodin soon, but not quite yet. Walking in the same careful, feet-wide-apart way, a half-filled glass of water in one hand, and the blood-soaked square of African in the other, Lisi made her way to the dusty book snake and sat down there, waiting to see what three geriatric Excedrin might do for her pain. And as she waited, her thoughts turned once more to the night she had found him in the guest room. In the guest room, but gone. "I kept thinking we were on our own. That wind, that smucking wind." 23. She's listening to that killer wind scream around the house, listening to snow grit whip against the windows, knowing they're on their own, that she is on her own. And as she listens, her thoughts turn once more to that night in New Hampshire when the hour was none and the moon kept teasing the shadows with its inconstant light. She remembers how she opened her mouth to ask if he could really do it, could really take her, and then closed it again, knowing it to be the kind of question you only ask when you want to play for time. And don't you only play for time when you're not on the same side? "We're on the same side," she remembers thinking. "If we're going to get married, we better be." But there was one question that needed asking, maybe because that night at the Antlers it was her turn to jump off the bench. "What if it's night over there? You said there are bad things over there at night." He smiled at her. "It's not, honey. How do you know? He shook his head, still smiling.
I just do. The way a kid's dog knows it's time to go sit by the mailbox because the school bus will be right along. It's almost sunset over there. It often is.
She didn't understand that, but didn't ask. One question always led on to another. That had been her experience, and the time for questions was done. If she meant to trust him, the time for questions was done. So she had taken a deep breath and said, All right, it's our front-loaded honeymoon. Take me someplace that isn't New Hampshire. This time I want a good look. He crushed his half-smoked cigarette in the ashtray and took her lightly by her upper arms, his eyes dancing with excitement and good humor. How well she remembers the feel of his fingers on her flesh that night.
You've got a yard of guts, little Lisey. I'll tell the world that. Hold on, and let's see what happens.
And he took me, Lisey thinks as she sits in the guest room, now holding the waxy cool hand of the breathing man doll in the rocker. But she feels the smile on her face, little Lisey, big smile, and wonders how long it's been there. He took me, I know he did. But that was 17 years ago, and we were both young and brave, and he was all present and accounted for. Now he's gone. Except his body is still here. Does that mean he can no longer go physically, as he did when he was a child? As she knows he has from time to time since she herself has known him? As he did from the hospital in Nashville, for example, when the nurse couldn't find him? It is then that Lisey feels the faint tightening of his hand on hers. It's almost imperceptible, but he is her love, and she feels it. His eyes still stare off toward the blank face of the TV from above the folds of the yellow African, but yes, his hand is squeezing hers. It is a kind of long-distance squeeze, and why not? He's plenty far away, even if his body is here, and where he is, he might be squeezing with all his might. Lisey has a sudden, brilliant intuition. Scott is holding a conduit open for her. God knows what it's costing him to do it, or how long he can keep it up, but that's what he's doing. Lisey lets go of his hand and gets up on her knees, ignoring the tingling burst of pins and needles in her legs, which have almost gone to sleep, likewise ignoring another great cold gust of wind that shakes the house. She tears away enough of the African so she can slide her arms between Scott's sides and his unresisting arms, so she can clasp her hands at the middle of his back and hug him. She puts her urgent face in the path of his blank stare.
Pull me, she whispers to him and gives his limp body a shake. Pull me to where you are, Scott.
There's nothing, and she raises her voice to a shout.
Pull me, goddamn you. Pull me to where you are so I can bring you home. Do it. If you want to come home, take me to where you are.
24. And you did, Lisey muttered. You did, and I did.
I'll be smucked if I know how this thing is supposed to work now that you're dead and gone, instead of just gomered out in the guest room. But that's what it's all been about, hasn't it? All of this.
And she did have an idea of how it was supposed to work. It was far back in her mind, just a shape behind that curtain of hers, but it was there. Meantime, the Excedrin had kicked in. Not a lot, but maybe enough so she could get down to the floor of the barn without passing out and breaking her neck. If she could get there, she could get into the house where the really good dope was stashed, assuming it still worked. It better work, because she had things to do and places to go, some of them far places indeed.
Journey of 1,000 miles begin with single step, Lisey-san, she said, and got up from the book snake.
Once more walking in slow, shuffling steps, Lisey set sail for the stairs. It took her almost 3 minutes to negotiate them, clinging to the banister every step of the way and pausing twice when she felt faint. But she made it without falling, sat for a little while on the sheeted Minegott bed to catch her breath, and then began the long expedition to the back door of her house. Chapter 11. Lisey and the Pool.
Shh, now you must be still.
1. Lisey's greatest fear, that the late morning heat would overcome her and she'd pass out halfway between the barn and the house, came to nothing. The sun obliged her by ducking behind a cloud, and a cap of cool breeze materialized to briefly soothe her overheated skin and flushed, swollen face. By the time she got to the back stoop, the deep laceration in her breast was pounding again, but the dark wings stayed away. There was a bad moment when she couldn't find her house key, but eventually her fumbling fingers touched the fob, a little silver elf, beneath the wad of Kleenex she usually carried in her right front pocket, so that was all right. And the house was cool. Cool and silent and blessedly hers. Now if it would only remain hers while she tended herself. No calls, no visitors, no 6-foot deputies lumbering up to the back door to check on her. Also, please God, pretty please, no return visit from the Black Prince of the Inkunks. She crossed the kitchen and got the white plastic basin out from under the sink. It hurt to bend, hurt a lot, and once more she felt the warmth of flowing blood on her skin and soaking the remains of her shredded top. He got off doing it, you know that, don't you? Of course she did. And he'll be back. No matter what you promise, no matter what you deliver, he'll be back. Do you know that, too? Yes, she knew that, too. Because to Jim Dooley, his deal with Woodbody and Scott's manuscripts are all just so much ding-dong for the Freesias. There's a reason why he went for your boob instead of your earlobe or maybe a finger. Sure, she told her empty kitchen, shady then suddenly bright as the sun sailed out from behind a cloud. It's the Jim Dooley version of great sex. And next time it will be my pussy if the cops don't stop him. You stop him, Lisey. You. Don't be silly, darling, she told the empty kitchen in her best Zsa Zsa Gabor voice. Once again using her right hand, she opened the cupboard over the toaster, took out a box of Lipton tea bags, and put them into the white basin. She added the bloody square of the African from Good Ma's cedar box, although she had absolutely no idea why she was still carrying it. Then she began trudging toward the stairs. What's silly about it? You stopped Blondie, didn't you? Maybe you didn't get the credit, but you were the one who did it. That was different. She stood looking up the stairs with the white plastic basin under her right arm, held against her hip so the box of tea and the piece of knitting wouldn't fall out. The stairs looked approximately 8 miles high. Lisey thought there really ought to be clouds swirling around the top. If it was different, why are you going upstairs? Because that's where the Vicodin is, she cried to the empty house. The damned old feel-better pills. The voice said one more thing and fell silent. So Weeza, baby love, is right, Lisey agreed. You better believe it. And she began the long, slow trek up the stairs. 2. Halfway up, the wings came back, darker than ever, and for a moment Lisey was sure she was going to black out. She was telling herself to fall forward, onto the stairs, rather than backward into space, when her vision cleared again. She sat down with the basin drawn across her legs and stayed that way, head hung over, until she had counted to 100 with a Mississippi between each number. Then she got up again and finished her climb. The second floor was cross-drafted and even cooler than the kitchen, but by the time Lisey got there, she was sweating profusely again. The sweat ran into the laceration across her breast, and soon there was a maddening salt sting on top of the deeper ache. And she was thirsty again, thirsty all the way down her throat and into her stomach, it seemed. That, at least, could be remedied, and the sooner the better. She glanced into the guest room as she made her slow way by. It had been redone since 1996, twice, actually, and she found it was all too easy to see the black rocking chair with the University of Maine seal on the back, and the blank eye of the television, and the windows filled with frost that changed color as the lights in the sky changed. Let it go, little Lisey. It's in the past. It's all in the past, but none of it's done, she cried irritably. That's the smucking trouble. To that there was no answer. But here, at long last, was the master bedroom and its adjacent bathroom, what Scott, never known for his delicacy, had been wont to call Il Grande Pupatorium. She set down the basin, dumped out the tooth glass, still 2 brushes, now both of them hers, alas, and filled the tumbler to the brim with cold water. This she drank off greedily, Then she did take a moment to look at herself. At her face, anyway. What she saw was not encouraging. Her eyes were glittering blue sparks peering out of dark caves. The skin beneath them had gone a dark blackish brown. Her nose was canted to the left. Lisi didn't think it was broken, but who knew? At least she could breathe through it. Below her nose was a great crust of dried blood that had broken both right and left around her mouth, giving her a grotesque Fu Manchu mustache. "Look, Ma, I'm a biker," she tried to say, but the words wouldn't quite come out. It was a shitty joke, anyway. Her lips were so severely swollen they actually turned out from the inside, giving her battered face a grotesquely exaggerated come-and-kiss-me pout. Was I thinking of going up to Greenlawn, home of the famous Hugh Albernus, in this condish? Was I really? Pretty funny. They'd get one look and then call for an ambulance to take me to a real hospital, the kind where they've got an ICU. That isn't what you were thinking. What you were thinking. But she closed that off, remembering something Scott used to say. 98% of what goes on in people's heads is none of their smucking business. Maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't. But for the time being, she'd do well to take this as she had the stairs, head down and one step at a time. Lisi had another bad moment when she couldn't find the Vicodin. She almost gave up, thinking one of the spring cleaning girls might have walked away with the bottle, before finding it hiding behind Scott's multivitamins. And, wonder of wonders, the expiration on these babies was this very month. Waste not, want not, Lisi said, and washed down three of them. Then she filled the plastic basin with lukewarm water and threw in a handful of tea bags. She watched the clear water begin to stain amber for a moment or two, then shrugged and dumped in the rest of the tea bags. They settled to the bottom of the darkening water, and she thought of a young man saying, "It stings a little bit, but it works really, really good." In another life, that had been. Now she would see for herself. She took a clean washcloth from the rod beside the sink, dropped it into the basin, and wrung it out gently. "What are you doing, Lisi?" she asked herself. But the answer was obvious, wasn't it? She was still following the trail her dead husband had left her, the one that led into the past. She let the tatters of her blouse slip to the bathroom floor and, with a grimace of anticipation, applied the tea-soaked washcloth to her breast. It did hurt, but compared to the nettlesome sting of her own sweat, it was almost pleasant, in an astringent mouthwash on the canker kind of way. "It works. It really, really works, Lisi." Once she had believed that, sort of, but once she had been 22 and willing to believe lots of things. What she believed in now was Scott. And Booyah Moon? Yes, she guessed she believed in that too. A world that was waiting right next door and behind the purple curtain in her mind. The question was whether or not it might be in reach for the celebrated writer's gal pal now that he was dead and she was on her own. Lisi wrung blood and tea out of the washcloth, dipped it again, replaced it on her wounded breast. This time the sting was even less. "But it's no cure," she thought. "Just another marker on the road into the past." Out loud, she said, "Another bool." Holding the washcloth gently against her and taking the bloody square of African, Good Ma's delight, in the hand folded beneath her breast, Lisi went slowly into the bedroom and sat down on the bed, looking at the silver spade with "Commencement, Shipman Library," incised on the scoop. Yes, she really could see a small dent where she'd connected first with Blondie's gun and then with Blondie's face. She had the spade, and although the yellow African in which Scott had wrapped himself on those cold nights in 1996 was long gone, she did have this remnant, this delight. "Bool, the end." "I wish it was the end," Lisi said, and lay back with the washcloth still on her breast. The pain was funneling away, but that was just Amanda's Vicodin taking hold, doing what neither Paul's tea cure nor Scott's out-of-date aspirin could. When the Vicodin wore off, the pain would be back. So would Jim Dooley, author of The Pain. The question was, what was she going to do in the meantime? Could she do something? "The one thing you absolutely cannot do is drift off to sleep." No, that would be bad.
I'd better hear from the prof by 8 tonight, or next time the hurtin' will be a lot worse, Dooley had told her. And Dooley had set things up so she was in a lose-lose situation. He had also told her to tend herself and not to tell anyone he'd been here. So far she'd done that, but not because she was afraid of being killed. In a way, knowing he meant to kill her anyway gave her a leg up. She didn't have to worry anymore about trying to reason with him, at least. But if she called the sheriff's department, well... "You can't go on a bool hunt when the house is full of great big clutter-bugging deputies," she said. Also, I believe that Scott's still having his say, or trying to. "Honey," she told the empty room, "I only wish I knew what it was." 3. She looked over at the digital clock on the bedside table and was astounded to see it was only 10:40. Already this day seemed 1,000 years long, but she suspected that was because she had spent so much of it reliving the past. Memories screwed up perspective, and the most vivid ones could annihilate time completely while they held sway. But enough about the past. What was happening right now? Well, Lisi thought, let's see. In the kingdom of Pittsburgh, the former king of the Incunks is no doubt suffering the sort of terror my late husband used to call stinky testicle syndrome. Deputy Alston's over in Cash Corners inspecting a little house fire. Arson suspected, dear. Jim Dooley? Maybe laid up in the woods near here, whittling on a stick with my OXO can opener in his pocket, waiting for the day to pass. His PT Cruiser could be tucked away in any one of a dozen deserted barns or sheds on the view, or in the deep cut across the Harlow town line. Darla's probably on her way to the Portland jetport to pick up Canty. Good Ma would say she's gone tooting. And Amanda? Oh, Amanda's gone, baby love. Just as Scott knew she would sooner or later. Didn't he do everything but reserve her a smuckin' room? Because it takes one to know one, as the saying is. Out loud, she said, "Am I supposed to go to Booyah Moon? Is that the next station of the bull? It is, isn't it? Scott, you goon, how do I do that with you dead?" "You're getting ahead of yourself again, aren't you?" "Sure, carrying on about her inability to reach a place she had as yet not given herself permission to fully remember." "You've got to do a lot more than lift that curtain and peep under the hem." "I've got to rip it down," she said dismally, "don't I?" No answer. Lisi took that for a yes. She rolled over on her side and picked up the silver spade. The inscription winked in the morning sunlight. She wrapped the bloody piece of African around the handle, then took hold of it that way. "All right," she said, "I'll rip it down. He asked me if I wanted to go, and I said all right. I said Geronimo." Lisi paused, thinking, "No, I didn't. I said it his way. I said Geronimo. And what happened? What happened then?" She closed her eyes, saw only brilliant purple, and could have cried for frustration. Instead, she thought, "Soweza, baby love. Strap on when it seems appropriate," and tightened her grip on the handle of the spade. She saw herself swinging it. She saw it glitter in the hazy August sun, and the purple parted before it, snapping back like skin after a slash, and what it let out wasn't blood, but light, amazing orange light that filled her heart and mind with a terrible mixture of joy, terror, and sorrow. No wonder she had repressed this memory all these years. It was too much, far too much. That light seemed to give the fading air of evening a silken texture, and the cry of a bird struck her ear like a pebble made of glass. A cap of breeze filled her nostrils with 100 exotic perfumes. Frangipani, bougainvillea, dusty roses, and, oh dear God, night-blooming cereus. Most of all, what pierced her was the memory of his skin on her skin, the beat of his blood running in counterpoint against the beat of her own, for they had been lying naked in their bed at the Antlers, and now knelt naked in the purple lupin near the top of the hill, naked in the thickening shadows of the sweetheart trees. And rising above one horizon came the orange mansion of the moon,
bloated and burning cold, while the sun sank below the other, boiling in a crimson house of fire. She thought that mixture of furious light would kill her with its beauty. Lying on her widow's bed, with the spade clamped in her hands, a much older Lisi cried out in joy for what was remembered, and grief for what was gone. Her heart was mended even as it was broken again. Cords stood out on her neck. Her swollen lips drew down and broke open, exposing her teeth and spilling fresh blood into the gutters of her gums. Tears ran from the corners of her eyes and slipped down her cheeks to her ears, where they hung like exotic jewelry. And the only clear thought in her mind was, "Oh, Scott, we were never made for such beauty. We were never made for such beauty. We should have died then, oh, my dear, we should have, naked and in each other's arms, like lovers in a story." "But we didn't," Lisi murmured. "He held me and said we couldn't stay long because it was getting dark and it wasn't safe after dark. Even most of the sweetheart trees turned bad then. But he said there was something he wanted." 4. "There's something I want to show you before we go back," he says, and pulls her to her feet. "Oh, Scott," she hears herself saying, very faint and weak. "Oh, Scott." It seems to be the only thing she can manage. In a way, this reminds her of the first time she felt an orgasm approaching, only this is drawn out and drawn out and drawn out. It's like all coming and no arrival. He's leading her someplace. She feels high grass whispering against her thighs. Then it's gone and she realizes they're on a well-worn path cutting through the drifts of lupin. It leads into what Scott calls the sweetheart trees, and she wonders if there are people here. If there are, how do they stand it? Lisi wonders. She wants to look again at that ascending goblin moon, but doesn't dare. "Be quiet under the trees," Scott says. "We should be okay a little longer, but better safe than sorry is a good rule to follow even on the edge of the fairy forest." Lisi doesn't think she could talk much above a whisper even if he demanded it. She's doing well to manage. "Oh, Scott." He's standing under one of the sweetheart trees now. It looks like a palm, only its trunk is shaggy, green with what looks like fur rather than moss. "God, I hope nothing's knocked it over," he says. "It was okay the last time I was here, the night you were so mad and I put my hand through that dumb greenhouse. Ah, okay, there." He pulls her off the path to the right, and near one of the two outlying trees that seem to guard the place where the path slips into the woods, she sees a simple cross made of two boards. To Lisi, they look like nothing more than crate slats. There's no burial mound. If anything, the ground here is slightly sunken. But the cross is enough to tell her it's a grave. On the marker's horizontal arm is one carefully printed word. "Paul." "The first time I did it in pencil," he says. His voice is clear, but it seems to be coming from far away. "Then I tried a ballpoint, but of course it didn't work. Not on rough wood like that. Magic marker was better, but it faded. Finally, I did it in black paint, from one of Paul's old paint-by-number kits." She looks at the cross in the strange mixed light of the dying day and the rising night, thinking, as much as she is able to think, "All of it's true. What seemed to happen when we came out from under the yum-yum tree really did happen. It's happening now, only longer and clearer." "Lisi!" He's hectic with joy, and why the hell not? He hasn't been able to share this place with anyone since Paul's death. The few times he's come here, he's had to come alone, to mourn alone. "There's something else. Let me show you." Somewhere a bell rings, very faint, a bell that sounds familiar. "Scott?"
"What?"
He's kneeling in the grass.
"What, baby love?"
"Did you hear..." But it stopped. And surely that was her imagination. "Nothing. What were you going to show me?"
Thinking, "As if you haven't shown me enough."
He's sweeping his hands through the high grass near the foot of the cross, but there seems to be nothing there, and slowly his goofy, happy smile begins to fade.
"Maybe something took it,"
he begins, then breaks off. His face tightens in a momentary wince, then relaxes,
and he lets loose a half-hysterical laugh. Here it is, and damn it if I didn't think I pricked myself on it. That'd be a joke on me, all right, after all these years. But the cap's still on. Look, Lisey.
She would have said nothing could divert her from the wonder of where she is. The red-orange sky in the east, and west deepening to a weird greenish-blue overhead. The exotic mixed odors, and somewhere, yes, another faint chime of some lost bell. But what Scott is holding up to the last fading daylight does the trick. It's the hypodermic needle his father gave him, the one Scott was supposed to stick Paul with once the boys were over here. There were little speckles of rust on the sleeve of metal at its base, but otherwise it looks brand new.
It was all I had to leave, Scott says. I didn't have a picture. The kids who went to donkey school used to get pictures, at least.
You dug the grave? Scott, you dug it with your bare hands?
I tried, and I did scoop out a little hollow. The ground here is soft. But the grass, pulling out the grass slowed me down. Tough old weeds, boy. And then it started getting dark and the laughers started.
The laughers?
Like hyenas, I think, only mean. They live in the fairy forest.
The fairy forest, did Paul name it that?
No, me.
He gestures to the trees.
Paul and I never saw the laughers up close, mostly just heard them. But we saw other things. I saw other things. There's this one thing.
Scott looks toward the rapidly darkening masses of sweetheart trees, then at the path, which fades away quickly when it enters the forest. There's no mistaking the caution in his voice when he speaks again.
We have to go back soon.
But you can take us, can't you?
With you to help, sure.
Then tell me how you buried him.
I can tell you that when we go back, if you...
But the slow shake of her head silences him.
No. I understand about why you don't want to have kids. I get that now. If you ever came to me and said, Lisey, I've changed my mind, I want to take the chance, we could talk about it because there was Paul, and then there was you.
Lisey, we could talk about it then. Otherwise, we're never going to talk about Gomers and Bad Gunky in this place again, okay?
She sees the way he's looking at her and softens her tone.
It's not about you, Scott. Not everything is, you know. This happens to be about me. It's beautiful here.
She looks around and she shivers.
It's too beautiful. If I spent too much time here, or even too much time thinking about it, I think the beauty would drive me insane. So if our time is short, for once in your smucking life, you be short. Tell me how you buried him.
Scott half turns away from her. The orange light of the setting sun paints the line of his body, flange of shoulder blade, tuck of waist, curve of buttock, the long, shallow arc of one thigh. He touches the arm of the cross. In the high grass, barely visible, the glass curve of the hypo glimmers, like a forgotten bit of trumpery treasure.
I covered him with grass, then I went home. I couldn't come back for almost a week. I was sick. I had a fever. Daddy gave me oatmeal in the morning and soup when he got home from work. I was as scared of Paul's ghost, but I'd never seen his ghost. Then I got better and tried to come here with Daddy's shovel from the shed. But it wouldn't go. Just me. I thought the animals, would have eaten on him. The laughers and such, but they didn't yet. So I went back and tried to come over again. This time with the play shovel I found in our old toy box in the attic. That went, and that's what I dug his grave with, Lisey. A red plastic play shovel we had for the sandbox when we was very wee.
The sinking sun has started to fade pink. Lisey puts her arm around him and hugs him. Scott's arms encircle her, and for a moment or two, he hides his face in her hair.
You loved him so very much, she says.
He was my brother, is what he replies, and it is enough. As they stand there in the growing gloom, she sees something else, or thinks she does. Another piece of wood? That's what it looks like. Another crate slat lying just beyond the place where the path leaves the lupin-covered hill, where lavender is now turning a steadily darker purple. No, not just one, two.
Is it another cross, she wonders, one that has fallen apart?
Scott, is someone else buried here? Huh? He sounds surprised. No. There's a graveyard, sure, but it's not here. It's by the... He catches sight of what she's looking at and gives a little chuckle.
Oh, wow. That's not a cross, it's a sign.
Paul made it right around the time of the first bull hunts, back when he could still come on his own sometimes.
I forgot all about that old sign.
He pulls free of her and hurries to where it lies. Hurries a little way down the path. Hurries under the trees. Lisey isn't sure she likes that. Scott, it's getting dark. Don't you think we better go?
In a minute, baby love. In just a minute.
He picks up one of the boards and brings it back to her. She can make out letters, but they're faint. She has to bring the slat close to her eyes before she can read what's there. To the pool.
Pool? Lisey asks.
Pool, he agrees. Rhymes with bool, don't you know? And actually laughs. Only that's when, somewhere deep in what he calls the fairy forest, where night has surely come already, the first laughers raise their voices. Only two or three, but the sound still terrifies Lisey more than anything she has ever heard in her life. To her, those things don't sound like hyenas. They sound like people, lunatics cast into the deepest depths of some 19th century bedlam. She grasps Scott's arm, digging into his skin with her nails, and tells him in a voice she barely recognizes as her own that she wants to go back. He has to take her back right now. Dim and distant, a bell tinkles. Yes, he says, tossing the signboard into the weeds. Above them, a dark draft of air stirs the sweetheart trees, making them sigh and give off a perfume that's stronger than the lupin, cloying almost sickly.
This isn't a safe place after dark. The pool is safe, and the beach, the benches, maybe even the graveyard, but...
More laughers join the chorus. In a matter of moments, there are dozens of them. Some of the laughter runs up a jagged scale and turns into broken glass screams that make Lisey feel like screaming back. Then they descend again, sometimes to guttering chuckles that sound as if they're coming from mud.
Scott, what are those things? She whispers.
Above his shoulder, the moon is a bloated gas balloon.
They don't sound like animals at all.
I don't know, they run on all fours, but sometimes they...
Never mind, I never saw them close up. Neither of us did.
Sometimes they what, Scott?
Stand up, like people. Look around. Doesn't matter. What matters is getting back. You want to go back now, right?
Yes. Then close your eyes and visualize our room at the Antlers. See it as well as you can. It will help me. It will give us a boost. She closes her eyes, and for one terrible second, nothing comes. Then she's able to see how the bureau and the tables flanking the bed swam out of the gloom when the moon fought clear of the clouds, and this brings back the wallpaper, rambler roses, and the shape of the bedstead, and the comic opera creak of the springs each time one of them moved. Suddenly, the terrifying sound of those things laughing in the forest, fairy forest, darkling woods, seems to be fading. The smells are fading too, and part of her is sad to be leaving this place, but mostly what she feels is relief. For her body, of course, and her mind, most certainly, but most of all for her soul. Her immortal smucking soul. Because maybe people like Scott Landon can jaunt off to places like Booyah Moon, but such strangeness and beauty were not made for ordinary folk such as she, unless it's between the covers of a book or inside the safe dark of a movie theater.
And I only saw a little, she thinks.
Good, he tells her, and Lisey hears both relief and surprised delight in his voice.
Lisey, you're a champ.
At this is how he finishes, but even before he does, before he lets go of her and she opens her eyes, Lisey knows. 5. I knew that we were home, she finished, and opened her eyes. The intensity of her recall was so great that for a moment she expected to see the moon-shadowy stillness of the bedroom they'd shared for two nights in New Hampshire 27 years ago. She had been gripping the silver spade so tightly that she had to will her fingers open, one by one. She laid the yellow delight square, blood-crusted but comforting, back on her breast. And then what? Are you going to tell me that after that, after all that, the two of you just rolled over and went to sleep? That was pretty much what had happened, yes. She'd been anxious to start forgetting all of it, and Scott had been more than willing. It had taken all his courage to bring his past up in the first place, and no wonder. But she had asked him one more question that night, she remembered, and had almost asked another the following day, when they were driving back to Maine, before realizing she didn't have to. The question she'd asked had been about something he'd said just before the laughers started up, scaring all curiosity from her mind. She'd wanted to know what Scott meant when he'd said, back when he could still come on his own sometimes. Meaning Paul. Scott looked startled. Been long years since I've thought of that, he said. But yeah, he could. It was just hard for him, the way hitting a baseball was always hard for me. So mostly he let me do it, and I think after a while he lost the knack completely. The question she'd thought to ask in the car was about the pool to which the broken sign had once pointed the way. Was it the one he always spoke about in his lectures? Lisi didn't ask because the answer was, after all, self-evident. His audiences might believe the myth pool, the language pool, to which we all go down to drink, to swim, or perhaps to catch a little fish, was figurative. She knew better. There was a real pool. She knew then because she knew him. She knew now because she had been there. You reached it from Sweetheart Hill by taking the path that led into the fairy forest. You had to pass both the bell tree and the graveyard to get there. I went to get him, she whispered, holding the spade. Then she abruptly said, Oh God, I remember the moon. And her body broke out so painfully in goose flesh that she writhed on the bed. The moon. Yes, that. A bloody orange hophead moon, so suddenly different from the northern lights and the killing cold she had just left behind her. It had been sexy summer crazy, that moon, darkly delicious, lighting the stone cleft of valley near the pool, better than she might have wished. She could see it now almost as well as then, because she had cut through the purple curtain, had ripped it most righteously. But memory was only memory, and Lisi had an idea hers had taken her almost as far as it could. A little more, maybe. Another picture or two from her own personal book snake. But not much, and then she would actually have to go back there, to Boo Yamoon. The question was, could she? Then another question occurred to her. What if he's one of the shrouded ones now? For an instant, an image struggled to come clear in Lisi's mind. She saw scores of silent figures that might have been corpses, wrapped in old-fashioned winding sheets. Only they were sitting up, and she thought they were breathing. A shudder rolled through her. It hurt her lacerated breast in spite of the Vicodin she had on board, but there was no way to stop that shudder until it had run its course. When it had, she found herself able to face practical considerations again. The foremost was whether she could get over to that other world on her own, because she had to go, shrouded ones or not. Scott had been able to do it on his own, and had been able to take his brother Paul. As an adult, he had been able to take Lisi from the antlers. The crucial question was what had happened 17 years later, on that cold January night in 1996. He wasn't entirely gone, she murmured. He squeezed my hand. Yes, and the thought had crossed her mind that somewhere he might have been squeezing with every ounce of his force and being, but did that mean he had taken her? I yelled at him to. Lisi actually smiled. Told him if he wanted to come home, he had to take me to where he was, and I always thought he did. Bullshit, little Lisi. You never thought about it at all, did you? Not until today, when you almost literally got your tit in the ringer and had to. So if you're thinking about it, really think about it. Did he pull you to him that night? Did he? She was on the verge of concluding it was one of those questions, like the chicken or egg thing, to which there was no satisfactory answer, when she remembered his saying, Lisi, you're a champ at this. Say she had done it by herself in 1996. Even so, Scott had been alive, and that squeeze of his hand, feeble as it had been, was enough to tell her that he was there on the other side, making a conduit for her. It's still there, she said. She was gripping the handle of the shovel again.
That way through is still there, it must be, because he prepared for all of this. Left me a smucking bull hunt to get me ready. Then yesterday morning, in bed with Amanda. That was you, Scott, I know it was. You said I had a blood bull coming, and a prize. A drink, you said. And you called me baby love. So where are you now? Where are you when I need you to get me over?
No answer but the ticking of the clock on the wall. Close your eyes. He'd said that too. Visualize. See as well as you can. It will help. Lisey, you're a champ at this.
I better be, she told the empty, sunny, Scottless bedroom. Oh, honey, I just better be.
If Scott Landon had had a fatal flaw, it might have been thinking too much, but that had never been her problem. If she had stopped to consider the situation on that hot day in Nashville, Scott almost certainly would have died. Instead, she had simply acted and saved his life with the shovel she now held.
I tried to come here with Daddy's shovel from the shed, but it wouldn't go.
Would the silver spade from Nashville go? Lisey thought yes, and that was good. She wanted to keep it with her. Friends to the end, she whispered, and closed her eyes. She was summoning her memories of Booyamoon, now vivid indeed, when a disturbing question broke her deepening concentration, another troublesome thought to divert her.
What time is it there, little Lisey?
Oh, not the hour, I don't mean that. But is it daytime or nighttime?
Scott always knew.
He said he did anyway. But you're not Scott.
No, but she remembered one of his favorite rock and roll tunes. Nighttime is the right time. In Booyamoon, nighttime was the wrong time, when smells turned rotten and food could poison you. Nighttime was when the laughers came out, things that ran on all fours but sometimes stood up like people and looked around. And there were other things, worse things. Things like Scott's long boy.
It's very close, honey.
That's what he had told her as he lay under the hot Nashville sun on the day when she had been sure he was dying.
I hear it taking its meal.
She had tried to tell him she didn't know what he was talking about. He had pinched her and told her not to insult his intelligence or her own.
Because I had been there.
Because I'd heard the laughers and believed him when he said there were worse things waiting. And there were. I saw the thing he was talking about. I saw it in 1996, when I went to Booyamoon to bring him home. Just its side, but that was enough.
It was endless, Lisey muttered, and was horrified to realize she really believed this to be the truth.
It had been night in 1996. Night when she had gone to Scott's other world from the cold guest room. She had gone down the path, into the woods, into the fairy forest, and a motor exploded into life nearby. Lisey's eyes flew open and she nearly screamed. Then she relaxed again little by little. It was only Herb Galloway, or maybe the Luttrell kid Herb sometimes hired, cutting the grass next door. This was entirely different from the bitterly cold night in January of 96, when she discovered Scott in the guest room, there and still breathing, but gone in every other way that mattered.
She thought, even if I could do it, I can't do it like this. It's too noisy.
She thought, the world is too much with us.
She thought, who wrote that? And, as happened so frequently, that thought came trailing its painful little red caboose. Scott would know.
Yes, Scott would know. She thought of him in all the motel rooms, bent over a portable typewriter.
Scott and Lisey, the early years, and then later, with his face lit by the glow of his laptop. Sometimes with a cigarette smoldering in an ashtray beside him, sometimes with a drink, always with the curl of hair falling forgotten across his forehead. She thought of him lying on top of her in this bed, of chasing her, full tilt through that awful house in Bremen. Scott and Lisey in Germany, both of them naked and laughing, horny but not really happy, while trucks and cars rumbled around and around the traffic circle up the street. She thought of his arms around her, all the times his arms had been around her, and the smell of him, and the sandpaper rasp his cheek made against hers, and she thought she would sell her soul, Yes, her immortal smucking soul. For no more than the sound of him down the hall, slamming the door and then yelling, "Hey, Lisey, I'm home. Everything the same?" Hush and close your eyes. That was her voice, but it was almost his, a very good imitation. So Lisey closed her eyes and felt the first warm tears, almost comforting, slip out through the screen of lashes. There was a lot they didn't tell you about death, she had discovered, and one of the biggies was how long it took the ones you loved most to die in your heart. It's a secret, Lisey thought, and it should be, because who would ever want to get close to another person if they knew how hard the letting go part was? In your heart, they only die a little at a time, don't they? Like a plant when you go away on a trip and forget to ask a neighbor to poke in once in a while with the old watering can, and it's so sad. She didn't want to think about that sadness, nor did she want to think about her hurt breast, where the pain had begun to creep back. She turned her thoughts to Booyah Moon again instead. She recalled how utterly amazing and wonderful it had been to go from the bitter sub-zero main night to that tropical place in the wink of a maiden's eye. The somehow sad texture of the air, and the silky aromas of frangipani and bougainvillea. She remembered the tremendous light of the setting sun and the rising moon and how, far off, that bell was ringing. That same bell. Lisey realized that the sound of the riding mower in the Galloway's yard now seemed oddly distant. So was the blat of a passing motorcycle. Something was happening, she was almost sure of it. A spring was winding, a well was filling, a wheel was turning. Maybe the world was not too much with her after all. But what if you get over there and it's night? Assuming that what you feel isn't just a combination of narcotics and wishful thinking, what if you get over there and it's night when the bad things come out? Things like Scott's long boy. Then I'll come back here. If you have time, you mean. Yes, that's what I mean. If there's... Suddenly, shockingly, the light shining through the lids of her closed eyes changed from red to a dim purple that was almost black. It was as if a shade had been pulled, but a shade wouldn't account for the glorious mixture of smells that suddenly filled her nose, the mixed perfume of all those flowers. Nor could she account for the grass she now felt pricking her calves and naked back. She'd made it, gotten over, come through. No, Lisey said with her eyes still shut, but it was feeble. Little more than a token protest. You know better, Lisey, Scott's voice whispered, and time is short. So wheeze it, baby love. And because she knew that voice was absolutely right, time was indeed short, Lisey opened her eyes and sat up in her talented husband's childhood refuge. Lisey sat up in Booyah Moon. 6. It was neither night nor day, and now that she was here, she wasn't surprised. She had come just before twilight on her previous two trips. Was it any wonder it was just before twilight again? The sun, brilliant orange, stood above the horizon at the end of the seemingly endless field of lupin. Looking the other way, Lisey could see the first rising arc of the moon, one far bigger than the biggest harvest moon she had ever seen in her life. That's not our moon, is it? How can it be? A breeze ruffled the sweaty ends of her hair, and somewhere not too far distant, that bell tinkled. A sound she remembered, a bell she remembered. You better hurry up, don't you think? Yes, indeed. It was safe at the pool, or so Scott had said, but the way there led through the fairy forest, and that was not. The distance was short, but she'd do well to hurry. She half ran up the slope to the trees, looking for Paul's marker. At first she didn't see it, then spotted it leaning far over to one side. She didn't have time to straighten the cross, but took the time anyway, because Scott would have taken the time. She set the silver spade aside for a moment. It had indeed come with her, as had the yellow knitted square, so she could use both hands. There must be weather here, because the single painstakingly printed word, Paul, had faded to little more than a ghost. I think I straightened it last time, too, she thought, in 96, and thought I'd like to look for the hypodermic needle, only there was no time. Nor was there now. This was her third real trip to Booyah Moon. The first hadn't been so bad because she'd been with Scott, and they'd gone no farther than the broken signpost reading to the pool, before returning to the bedroom at the Antlers. The second time, however, in 1996, she'd had to take the path into the fairy forest on her own. She couldn't recall what bravery she must have summoned, not knowing how far it was to the pool or what she'd find when she got there. Not that this trip didn't have its own unique set of difficulties. She was topless, her badly gored left breast was starting to throb again, and God only knew what sort of things the smell of her blood might attract. Well, it was too late to worry about that now. And if something does come at me, she thought, picking up the spade by its short wooden handle, one of those laughers, for instance, I'll just bop at one with little Lisi's trusty maniac swatter, copyright 1988, patent pending, all rights reserved. Somewhere up ahead, that bell tinkled again. Barefoot, bare-breasted, blood-smeared, wearing nothing but a pair of old denim shorts and carrying a spade with a silver scoop in her right hand, Lisi set off toward the sound along the rapidly darkening path. The pool was up ahead, surely no more than half a mile distant. There it was safe even after dark, and she would take off the few clothes she still wore and wash herself clean. 7. It grew dim very quickly once she was under the canopy of trees. Lisi felt the urge to hurry more strongly than ever, but when the wind stirred the bell again, it was very close now, and she knew it was hung from a branch by a bit of stout cord. She stopped, struck by a complex overlay of recall. She knew the bell was hung on a piece of cord because she had seen it on her last trip here, 10 years ago. But Scott had swiped it long before that, even before they were married. She knew because she had heard it in 1979. Even then it had sounded familiar, in an unpleasant way. Unpleasant because she had hated the sound of that bell long before it had come over here to Booyah Moon. "And I told him," she murmured, switching the spade to her other hand and brushing back her hair. The yellow square of delight lay over her left shoulder. Around her the sweetheart trees rustled like whispering voices. He didn't say much, but I guess he took it to heart. She set off again. The path dipped, then rose to the top of the hill where the trees were a little thinner and a strong red light shone through them. Not quite sunset yet, then. Good. And here the bell hung, nodding from side to side just enough to produce the faintest chime. It had, once upon a time, sat beside the cash register of Pat's Pizza and Cafe in Cleves Mills. Not the kind of bell you hit with your palm, the discreet hotel desk species that went ding once and then shut up, but a kind of miniature silver school bell with a handle that went ding-a-ling for as long as you wanted to keep on shaking it. And Chucky G., the cook who was on duty most nights during the year or so Lisi had waitressed at Pat's, had loved that bell. Sometimes, she remembered telling Scott, she heard its annoying silver ding-a-ling in her dreams, along with Chucky G. bawling, leather-lunged, "Orders up, Lisi. Come on, let's hustle. Hungry people." Yes, in bed she had told Scott how much she had hated Chucky G.'s annoying little bell. In the spring of 1979, it must have been, because not long after that annoying little bell had disappeared. She'd never associated Scott with its disappearance, not even when she'd heard it the first time she'd been here. Too many other things going on then, too much weird input, and he had never said a word about it. Then, in 1996, while searching for him, she had heard Chucky G.'s long-lost bell again, and that time she had, "Let's hustle, hungry people, orders up," known it for what it was. And the whole thing had made perfect crackpot sense. Scott Landon had been the man, after all, who thought the Auburn novelty shop was the hearty-har capital of the universe. Why wouldn't he have thought it a fine joke to swipe the bell that so annoyed his girlfriend and bring it to Booyah Moon, to hang it right here beside the path for the wind to ring? "There was blood on it last time," the deep voice of memory whispered. "Blood in 1996. Yes, and it had frightened her, but she had pushed on anyway, and the blood was gone now. The weather that had faded Paul's name from the marker's crosspiece had also washed the bell clean, and the stout length of cord upon which Scott had hung it 27 years before always assuming time was the same over here, had almost worn away. Soon the bell would tumble to the path. Then the joke would be over. And now intuition spoke to her as powerfully as it ever had in her life, not in words, but in a picture. She saw herself laying the silver spade at the foot of the bell tree, and she did so without pause or question. Nor did she ask herself why. It looked too perfect lying there at the foot of the old, gnarled tree. Silver bell above, silver spade below. As to why it should be perfect, she might as well ask herself why Booyah Moon existed in the first place. She'd thought the spade had been made for her protection this time. Apparently not. She gave it one more look, it was all the time she could afford, and then moved on. 8. The path led her down into another fold of forest. Here the strong red light of evening had faded into dimming orange, and the first of the laughers woke somewhere ahead of her in the darker reaches of the woods, its horribly human voice climbing that glass mad ladder and making her arms break out in goose flesh.
Hurry, baby love.
Yes, all right. Now a second laugher joined the first, and although she felt more goose flesh ripple up her bare back, she thought she was all right. Just up ahead, the path curved around a vast gray rock she remembered very well. Beyond it lay a deep rock hollow. Oh yes, deep and perfectly huge. And the pool. At the pool, she would be safe. It was scary at the pool, but it was also safe. Lisi became suddenly, queerly positive that something was stalking her, just waiting for the last of the light to drain away before making its move. Its lunge. Heart pounding so hard it hurt her mutilated breast, she dodged around the great gray bulk of that protruding stone. And the pool was there, lying below like a dream made real. As she looked down at that ghostly shining mirror, the last memories clicked into place. And remembering was like coming home. 9. She comes around the gray rock and forgets all about the dried smear of blood on the bell, which has so troubled her. She forgets the screaming windy cold and brilliant northern lights she has left behind. For a moment she even forgets Scott, whom she's come here to find and bring back, always assuming he wants to come. She looks down at the ghostly shining mirror of the pool and forgets everything else, because it's beautiful, and even though she's never been here before in her life, it's like coming home. Even when one of those things starts to laugh, she isn't afraid, because this is safe ground. She doesn't need anyone to tell her that. She knows it in her bones, just as she knows Scott has been talking about this place in his lectures and writing about it in his books for years. She also knows that this is a sad place. It's the pool where we all go down to drink, to swim, to catch a little fish from the edge of the shore. It's also the pool where some hardy souls go out in their flimsy wooden boats after the big ones. It is the pool of life, the cup of imagination, and she has an idea that different people see different versions of it, but with two things ever in common. It's always about a mile deep in the fairy forest, and it's always sad. Because imagination isn't the only thing this place is about. It's also about giving in, waiting, just sitting, and looking out over those dreamy waters, and waiting. It's coming, you think. It's coming soon, I know it is. But you don't know exactly what, and so the years pass. How can you know that, Lisi? The moon told her, she supposes. And the northern lights that burn your eyes with their cold brilliance, the sweet dust smell of roses and frangipani on Sweetheart Hill. Most of all, Scott's eyes told her, as he struggled just to hold on, hold on, hold on, to keep from taking the path that led to this place. More cackling voices rise in the deeper reaches of the woods, and then something roars, momentarily silencing them. Behind her, the bell tinkles, then falls still again. I ought to hurry. Yes, even though she senses hurry is antithetical to this place. They need to be getting back to their house on Sugartop as soon as possible, and not because there's danger of wild beasts, of ogres and trolls, and verts and seamies. other strange creatures deep in the fairy forest where it's always dark as a dungeon and the sun never shines. But because the longer Scott stays here, the less likely she'll ever be able to bring him back. Also, Lisi thinks of how it would be to see the moon burning like a cold stone in the still surface of the pool below, and she thinks, I might get fascinated. Yes. Old wooden steps lead down this side of the slope. Beside each one is a stone post with a word carved into it. She can read these in Buyamun, but knows they would mean nothing to her back home, nor will she be able to remember anything but the simplest. Kai Gamma means bread. The stairs end in a downsloping ramp running to her left that finally empties at ground level. Here a beach of fine white sand glimmers in the rapidly failing light. Above the beach, carved on step backs into a rock wall, are perhaps 200 long, curved stone benches that look down on the pool. There might be space for 1,000 or even 2,000 people here if they were seated side by side, but they're not. She thinks there can be no more than 50 or 60 in all, and most of them are hidden in gauzy wrappings that look like shrouds. But if they're dead, how can they be sitting? Does she even want to know? On the beach, standing scattered, are maybe 2 dozen more, and a few people, 6 or 8, are actually in the water. They wade silently. As Lisi reaches the bottom of the steps and begins making her way toward the beach, her feet treading easily along the sunken rut of a path many other feet have walked before her, she sees a woman bend over and begin to lave her face. She does this with the slow gestures of someone in a dream, and Lisi recalls that day in Nashville, how everything fell into slow motion when she realized Blondie meant to shoot her husband. That was also like a dream, but wasn't. Then she sees Scott. He's sitting on a stone bench, 9 or 10 rows up from the pool. He's still got good Ma's African, only here it's not bundled around him because it's too warm. It's just drawn across his knees, with the balance puddled over his feet. She doesn't know how the African can be both here and in the house on the view at the same time, and thinks, maybe because some things are special, the way Scott is special. And she? Is a version of Lisi Landon still back in the house on Sugartop Hill? She thinks not. She thinks she is not that special, not her, not little Lisi. She thinks that, for better or worse, she is entirely here, or entirely gone, depending on which world you're talking about. She pulls in breath, meaning to call his name, then doesn't. A powerful intuition stops her. Shh, she thinks. Shh, little Lisi, now. 10. Now you must be still, she thought, as she had in January of 1996. All was as it had been then, only now she saw a little better because she had come a little earlier. The shadows in the stone valley that cupped the pool were only beginning to gather. The water had the shape, almost, of a woman's hips. At the beach end, where the hips would nip into the waist, was an arrowhead of fine white sand. Upon it, standing far apart from one another, were 4 people, 2 men and 2 women, staring raptly at the pool. In the water were 6 more. No one was swimming. Most were in no deeper than their calves. 1 man was in up to his waist. Lisi wished she could have read the expression on this man's face, but she was still too far away. Behind the waders and the people standing on the beach, those who hadn't yet found enough courage to get wet, Lisi was convinced, was the sloping headland that had been carved into dozens or maybe hundreds of stone benches. Upon them, widely scattered, sat as many as 200 people. She seemed to remember only 50 or 60, but this evening there were definitely more. Yet for every person she could see, there had to be at least 4 in those horrible cerements, wrappings. There's a graveyard, too, do you remember? Yes, Lisi whispered. Her breast was hurting badly again, but she looked at the pool and remembered Scott's sliced-up hand. She also remembered how quickly he had recovered from being shot in the lung by the madman. Oh, the doctors had been amazed. There was better medicine than Vicodin for her, and not far away.
Yes, she said again, and began making her way along the downsloping path, this time with only one unhappy difference. There was no Scott Landon sitting on a bench down there. Just before the path ended at the beach, she saw another path, splitting off to her left and away from the pool. Lisi was once more all but overwhelmed by memory as she saw the moon. 11. She sees the moon rising through a kind of slot in the massive granite outcropping that cups the pool. That moon is bloated and gigantic, just as it was when her husband-to-be brought her to Buya Moon from their bedroom at the Antlers. But in the widening clearing to which that slot leads, its infected red-orange face is broken into jagged segments by the silhouettes of trees and crosses. So many crosses. Lisi is looking into what might almost be a rustic country graveyard. Like the cross Scott made for his brother Paul, these appear to be made of wood, and although some are quite large and a few are ornate, they all look handmade, and many are worse for wear. There are rounded markers as well, and some of these might be made of stone, but in the gathering gloom, Lisi cannot tell for sure. The light of the rising moon hinders rather than helps, because everything in the graveyard is backlit. If there's a graveyard here, why did he bury Paul back there? Was it because he died with the bad gunky? She doesn't know or care. What she cares about is Scott. He's sitting on one of those benches like a spectator at a badly attended sporting event. And if she intends to do something, she'd better get busy. Keep your string a-drawing, Good Ma would have said. That was one she caught from the pool. Lisi leaves the graveyard and its rude crosses behind. She walks along the beach toward the stone benches where her husband sits. The sand is firm and somehow tingly. Feeling it against her soles and heels makes her realize that her feet are bare. She's still wearing her nightgown and layers of underthings, but her slippers didn't travel. The feel of the sand is dismaying and pleasant at the same time. It's also strangely familiar, and as she reaches the first step of the stone benches, Lisi makes the connection. As a kid, she had a recurring dream in which she'd go zooming around the house on a magic carpet, invisible to everyone else. She'd awaken from those dreams exhilarated, terrified, and sweat-soaked to the roots of her hair. This sand has the same magic carpet feel. As if she were to bend her knees and then shoot upward, she might fly instead of jump. I'd swoop over that pool like a dragonfly, maybe dragging my toes in the water. Swoop around to the place where it outflows in a brook. Along to where the brook fattens into a river, swooping low. Smelling the damp rising up from the water, breaking through the little rising mists like scarves until I finally reached the sea, and then on, yes, on and on and on. Tearing herself away from this powerful vision is one of the hardest things Lisi has ever done. It's like trying to rise after days of hard work and only a few hours of heavy and beautifully restful sleep. She discovers she's no longer on the sand, but sitting on a bench in the third tier up from the little beach, looking out at the water with her chin propped on her palm. And she sees that the moonlight is losing its orange glow. It has become buttery and will soon turn to silver. How long have I been here? She asks herself, dismayed. She has an idea it's not really been that long, somewhere between 15 minutes and half an hour. But even that is far too long. Although she certainly understands how this place works now, doesn't she? Lisi feels her eyes being drawn back to the pool, the peace of the pool, where now only two or three people, one is a woman with either a large bundle or a small child in her arms, are wading in the deepening evening, and forces herself to look away, up at the rock horizons that encircle this place, and at the stars peeping through the darkening blue above the granite and the few trees that fringe it up there. When she begins to feel a little more like herself, Lisi stands up, turns her back on the water, and locates Scott again. It's easy. That yellow-knitted African all but screams, even in the gathering dark. She goes to him, stepping up from one level to the next, as she would at a football stadium. She detours away from one of the shrouded creatures,
but she's close enough to see the very human shape beneath its gauzy wrappings. Hollow eye sockets, and one hand that peeps out. It's a woman's hand, with chipped red polish on the nails. When she reaches Scott, her heart is pumping hard and she feels a little out of breath, even though the climb hasn't been difficult. In the distance, the laughers have begun cackling up and down the scale, sharing their endless joke. Back the way she came, faint but still audible, she hears the fitful tinkle of Chuck E. Cheese's bell, and she thinks, "Order's up, Lisey. Come on, let's hustle." "Scott," she murmurs, but Scott doesn't look at her. Scott is looking raptly at the pool, where the faintest hazy mist, a mere exhalation, has begun to rise in the light of the rising moon. Lisey allows herself only one quick glance that way before returning her regard firmly to her husband. She's learned her lesson about looking too long at the pool, or so she hopes. "Scott, it's time to come home." Nothing. No response whatsoever. She remembers protesting that he wasn't crazy, writing stories didn't make him crazy, and Scott telling her, "I hope you stay lucky, little Lisey." But she hadn't, had she? Now she knows a lot more. Paul Landon went bad gunky and wound up raving his life away chained to a post in the cellar of an isolated farmhouse. His younger brother has married and had an undeniably brilliant career, but now the bill has come due. "Your garden variety catatonic," she thinks, and shivers. "Scott," she murmurs again, almost directly into his ear. She has taken both of his hands in hers. They are cool and smooth, waxy and lax. "Scott, if you're in there and you want to come home, squeeze my hands." For the longest time, there's nothing but the sound of the laughing things deep in the woods, and somewhere closer by the shocking, almost womanish cry of a bird. Then Lisey feels something that is either wishful thinking or the barest twitch of his fingers against hers. She tries to think what she should do next, but the only thing she's sure of is what she shouldn't do. Let the night swim up around them, dazzling her with silvery moonlight from above, even as it drowns her in shadows rising from below. This place is a trap. She's sure that anyone who stays at the pool for very long will find it impossible to leave. She understands that if you look at it for a little while, you'll be able to see anything you want to. Lost loves, dead children, missed chances, anything. The most amazing thing about this place? That there aren't more people hanging out on the stone benches. That they aren't packed in shoulder to shoulder like spectators at a smucking World Cup soccer match. She catches movement in the corner of her eye and looks up the path leading from the beach to the stairs. She sees a stout gentleman wearing white pants and a billowing white shirt open all the way down the front. A giant red gash runs down the left side of his face. His iron gray hair is standing up at the back of his oddly flattened-looking head. He looks around briefly, then steps from the path to the sand. Beside her, speaking with great effort, Scott says, "Car crash." Lisey's heart takes a wild spring in her chest, but she's careful not to look around or to squeeze down too tightly on his hands, although she cannot forbear a slight twitch. Striving to keep her voice even, she says, "How do you know?" No answer from Scott. The stout gentleman in the billowing shirt spares one more dismissive glance for the silent folks sitting on the stone benches, then turns his back on them and wades into the pool. Silver tendrils of moon smoke rise around him, and Lisey once more has to drag her eyes away. "Scott, how do you know?" He shrugs. His shoulders also seem to weigh 1,000 pounds. That, at least, is how it looked to her. But he manages. "Telepathy, I suppose." "Will he get better now?" There's a long pause. Just when she thinks he won't answer, he does. "He might," he says. It's deep in here." Scott touches his own head, indicating, Lisey thinks, some sort of brain injury. "Sometimes things just go too far." "Then do they come and sit here? Wrap themselves up in sheets?" Nothing from Scott. What she's afraid of now is losing what little of him she's found. She doesn't need anyone to tell her how easily it could happen. She can feel it. Every nerve in her body knows this news. Scott, I think you want to come back. I think it's why you hung on so hard all last December. And I think it's why you brought the African. It's hard to miss, even in the gloom. He looks down, as if seeing it for the first time, then actually smiles a little. You're always saving me, Lisi, he says. I don't know what you're... Nashville. I was going down. With every word he seems to gain animation. For the first time she allows herself to really hope. I was lost in the dark and you found me. I was hot. So hot. And you gave me ice. Do you remember? She remembers that other Lisa. I spilled half the fucking coke getting back here. And how Scott's shivering suddenly stopped when she popped a sliver of ice onto his bloody tongue. She remembers coke-colored water dripping out of his eyebrows. She remembers it all. Of course I do. Now let's get out of here. He shakes his head, slowly but firmly. It's too hard. You go on, Lisi. I'm supposed to go without you? She blinks her eyes fiercely, only realizing when she feels the sting that she has begun to cry. It won't be hard. Do it like that time in New Hampshire. He speaks patiently, but still very slowly, as if every word were a great weight, and he is purposely misunderstanding her. She's almost sure of it. Just close your eyes. Concentrate on the place you came from. See it, and that's the place you'll go back to. Without you? She repeats fiercely, and below them, slowly, like a man moving underwater, a guy in a red flannel shirt turns to look at them. Scott says, Shh, Lisi. Here you must be still. What if I don't want to be? This isn't the smucking library, Scott. Deep in the fairy forest, the laughers howl, as if this is the funniest thing they've ever heard. A knee slapper worthy of the Auburn novelty shop. From the pool, there's a single sharp splash. Lisi glances that way and sees the stout gentleman has gone to... well, to somewhere else. She decides she doesn't give a good goddamn if it's underwater or Dimension X. Her business now is with her husband. He's right. She's always saving him. Just call her the U.S. Cavalry. And it's okay. She knew that practical shit was never exactly going to be Scott's main deal when she married him. But she has a right to expect a little help, doesn't she? His gaze has drifted back to the water. She has an idea that when night comes and the moon begins to burn there like a drowned lamp, she'll lose him for good. This frightens and infuriates her. She stands up and snatches Goodma's African. It came from her side of the family, after all. And if this is to be their divorce, she will have it back, all of it, even if it hurts him. Especially if it hurts him. Scott looks at her with an expression of sleepy surprise that makes her angrier still. Okay, she says, speaking with brittle lightness. It's a tone foreign to her and seemingly to this place as well. Several people look around, clearly disturbed and, perhaps, irritated. Well, smuck them and the various horses or hearses or ambulances they rode in on. You want to stay here and eat lotuses or whatever the saying is? Fine. I'll just go on back down the path. And for the first time, she sees a strong emotion on Scott's face. It's fear. Lisi, no, he says. Just boom back from here. You can't use the path. It's too late, almost night. Shh, someone says. Fine. She'll shh. Bundling the yellow African higher in her arms, Lisi starts back down the risers. Two benches down from the bottom, she chances a glance back. Part of her is sure that he'll follow her. This is Scott, after all. No matter how strange this place may be, he's still her husband, still her lover. The idea of divorce has crossed her mind, but surely it is absurd, a thing for other people but not for Scott and Lisi. He will not allow her to leave alone. But when she looks over her shoulder, he's just sitting there in his white t-shirt and green long underwear bottoms, with his knees together and his hands clasped tightly as if he is cold even here, where the air is so tropical. He's not coming, and for the first time Lisi lets herself acknowledge that it may be because he can't. If that is so, her choices are down to a pair. Stay here with him, or go home without him. No, there's a third. I can gamble. I can shoot the works, as the saying is. Bet the farm. So come on, Scott. If the path is really dangerous, get off your dead ass and keep me from taking it. She wants to look back as she crosses the beach, but doing that would show weakness. The laughers are closer now, which means that whatever else might be lurking near the path back to Sweetheart Hill will be closer too. It will be full dark by now under the trees, and she guesses she'll have that sense of something stalking her before she gets far, that sense of something closing in. It's very close, honey, Scott told her that day in Nashville as he lay on the broiling pavement, bleeding from the lung and near death. And when she tried to tell him she didn't know what he was talking about, he had told her not to insult his intelligence. Or her own. Never mind. I'll deal with whatever's in the woods when, if, I have to. All I know right now is that Dandy DeBusschere's girl Lisi has finally got it strapped all the way on. That mysterious it, Scott said you could never define because it changed from one jackpot to the next. This is the total deal, Soeza, baby love. And you know what? It feels pretty good. She begins making her way up the slanting path that leads to the steps, and behind her... 12. He called me, Lisi murmured. One of the women who had been standing at the edge of the pool now stood up to her knees in that still water, looking dreamily off to the horizon. Her companion turned to Lisi, her brows drawn together in a disapproving frown. At first, Lisi didn't understand. Then she did. People didn't like you to talk here. That hadn't changed. She had an idea that in Booyah Moon, few things did. She nodded, as if the frowning woman had requested clarification. My husband called my name, tried to stop me. God knows what it cost him to do that, but he did. The woman on the beach, her hair was blonde but dark at the roots, as if it needed touching up, said, Be quiet, please. I need to think. Lisi nodded, fine by her, although she doubted the blonde woman was doing as much thinking as she might believe, and waded into the water. She thought it would be cool, but in fact it was almost hot. The heat coursed up her legs and made her sex tingle in a way it hadn't in a long time. She waded out farther but got no deeper than her waist. She took another half dozen steps, looked around, and saw she was at least 10 yards beyond the farthest of the other waders, and remembered that good food turned bad after dark in Booyah Moon. Might the water also turn bad? Even if it didn't, might not dangerous things come out here as well as in the woods? Pool sharks, so to speak? And if that was the case, might she not find herself too far out to get back before one of them decided dinner was served? This is safe ground. Only it wasn't ground, it was water. And she felt a panicky urge to flounder back to the beach before some killer U-boat with teeth took off one of her legs. Lisi fought the fear down. She had come a long way, not just once, but twice. Her breast hurt like hell, and by God, she would get what she'd come for. She took in a deep breath, and then, not knowing what to expect, lowered herself slowly to her knees on the sandy bottom, letting the water cover her breasts. The one that was unhurt, and the one that was badly wounded. For a moment, her left breast hurt more than ever. She thought the pain would tear the top of her head off. But then... 13. He calls her name again, loud and panicky. Lisi! It cuts through the dreamy silence of this place like an arrow with fire at its tip. She almost looks back because there's agony as well as panic in that cry. But something deep inside her tells her she must not. If she is to have any chance at all of rescuing him, she must not look back. She has made her wager. She passes the graveyard, its crosses gleaming in the light of the rising moon, with hardly a glance, and climbs the steps with her back straight and her head up, still holding Goodma's African bundled high in her arms so she won't trip on it. And she feels a crazy exhilaration, the kind she reckons you only experience when you've put everything you own, the house, the car, the bank account, the family dog, on one throw of the dice. Above her, and not far, is the vast gray rock marking the head of the path that leads back to Sweetheart Hill. The sky is filled with strange stars and foreign constellations. Somewhere, the northern lights are burning in long curtains of color. Lisi may never see them again, but she thinks she's okay with that. She reaches the top of the steps and with no hesitation walks around the rock, and that is when Scott pulls her backward against him. His familiar odor has never smelled so good to her. At the same moment, she becomes aware that something is moving on her left, moving fast. Not on the path leading to the Hill of Lupins, but just beside it. "Shh, Lisi," Scott whispers. His lips are so close they tickle the cup of her ear. "For your life and mine, now you must be still." It's Scott's long boy. She doesn't need him to tell her. For years she has sensed its presence at the back of her life, like something glimpsed in a mirror from the corner of the eye, or, say, a nasty secret hidden in the cellar. Now the secret is out. In gaps between the trees to her left, sliding at what seems like express train speed, is a great high river of meat. It is mostly smooth, but in places there are dark spots or craters that might be moles or even, she supposes, she does not want to suppose and cannot help it, skin cancers. Her mind starts to visualize some sort of gigantic worm, then freezes. The thing over there, behind those trees, is no worm, and whatever it is, it's sentient, because she can feel it thinking. Its thoughts aren't human, aren't in the least comprehensible, but there is a terrible fascination in their very alienness. It's the bad gunky, she thinks, cold all the way to the bone. Its thoughts are the bad gunky and nothing else. The idea is awful, but also right. A sound escapes her, something between a squeal and a moan. It's just a little sound, but she sees or senses that the thing's endless express train progress has suddenly slowed, that it may have heard her. Scott knows, too. The arm around her, just below her breasts, tightens a bit more. Once again, his lips move against the cup of her ear. "If we're going home, we have to go right now," he murmurs. He's totally with her again, totally here. She doesn't know if it's because he's no longer looking at the pool or because he's terrified. Maybe it's both. "Do you understand?" Lisi nods. Her own fear is so great it's incapacitating, and any sense of exhilaration at having him back is gone. Has he lived with this all his life? If so, how has he lived with it? But even now, in the extremity of her terror, she supposes she knows. Two things have tied him to the earth and saved him from the long boy. His writing is one. The other has a waist he can put his arms around and an ear into which he can whisper. "Concentrate, Lisi. Do it now. Bust your brains." She closes her eyes and sees the guest room of their house on Sugartop Hill, sees Scott sitting in the rocker, sees herself sitting on the chilly floor beside him, holding his hand. He is gripping her hand as hard as she is gripping his. Behind them, the frost-filled panes of the window are filled with fantastic shifting light. The TV is on, and the last picture show is once more playing. The boys are in Sam the Lion's black-and-white pool room, and Hank Williams is on the jute singing Jambalaya. For a moment, she feels Booyah Moon shimmer, but then the music in her mind, music that was for a moment so clear and happy, fades. Lisi opens her eyes. She's desperate to see home, but the big gray rock and the path leading away through the sweetheart trees are both still there. Those strange stars still blaze down, only now the laughers are silent, and the harsh whispering of the bushes has stilled, and even Chuck E. Cheese's bell has quit its fitful tinkling, because the long boy has stopped to listen, and the whole world seems to hold its breath and listen with it. It's over there, not 50 feet away on their left. Lisi can now actually smell it. It smells of old farts in turnpike rest area bathrooms, or the poison whiff of bourbon and cigarette smoke you sometimes get when you turn the key and walk into a cheap motel room, or good Ma's pissy diapers when she was old and raving senile. It stopped behind the nearest rank of sweetheart trees, has paused in its tunnelish run through the woods. And dear God, they aren't going. They aren't going back. They are, for some reason, stuck here. Scott's whisper is now so low, he hardly seems to be speaking at all. If not for the faint sensation of his lips moving against the sensitive skin of her ear, she could almost believe this was telepathy. It's the African, Lisi. Sometimes things will go one way, but not the other. Usually things that can double. I don't know why, but that's it. I feel it like an anchor. Drop the African. Lisi opens her arms and lets it fall. The sound it makes is only the softest sigh, like the arguments against insanity falling into some ultimate basement. But the long boy hears it. She feels a shift in the rowing direction of its unknowable thoughts, feels the hideous pressure of its insane regard. One of the trees snaps with an explosive rending noise as the thing over there begins to turn, and she closes her eyes again and sees the guest room as clearly as she has ever seen anything in her life, sees it with desperate intensity and through a perfect magnifying lens of terror. "Now," Scott murmurs, and the most amazing thing happens. She feels the air turn inside out. Suddenly, Hank Williams is singing Jambalaya. He's singing... 14. He was singing because the TV was on. She could now remember this as clearly as anything in her life, and she wondered how she ever could have forgotten it. Time to get off memory lane, Lisi. Time to go home. Everybody out of the pool, as the saying was. Lisi had gotten what she'd come here for, had gotten it while caught up in that last terrible memory of the long boy. Her breast still hurt, but the fierce throbbing was down to a dull ache. She had felt worse as a teenager, after spending a long hot day in a bra that was too small for her. From where she knelt, chin deep in the water, she could see that the moon, now smaller and almost pure silver, had risen above all but the highest of the trees in the graveyard. And now a new fear rose to trouble her. What if the long boy came back? What if it heard her thinking about it and came back? This was supposed to be a safe place, and Lisi thought it probably was. From the laughers and the other nasty things that might live in the fairy forest, at least. But she had an idea that the long boy might not be bound by any rules that held the other things away from here. She had an idea the long boy was... different. The title of some old horror story first occurred to her, then clanged in her mind like an iron bell. "Oh, whistle, and I'll come to you, my lad." This was followed by the title of the only Scott Landon book she had ever hated, Empty Devils. But before she could start back to the sand, before she could even get to her feet again, Lisi was struck by yet another memory. This one far more recent. It was of waking in bed with her sister Amanda just before dawn and finding that past and present had gotten all tangled together. Worse still, Lisi had come to believe that she wasn't in bed with her sister at all, but with her dead husband. And in a way, that had been true. Because although the thing in bed with her had been wearing Amanda's nightgown and had spoken in Amanda's voice, it had used the interior language of their marriage and phrases only Scott could have known. "You have a blood pool coming," the thing in bed with her had said, and along had come the Black Prince of the Inkunks with her own OXO can opener in his nasty bag of tricks. "It goes behind the purple. You've already found the first three stations. A few more and you'll get your prize." And what prize had the thing in bed with her promised? A drink. She had guessed a Coke or an RC Cola because those had been Paul's prizes. But now she knew better. Lisi lowered her head, buried her battered face in the pool, and then, without allowing herself to think about what she was doing, took two quick swallows. The water in which she stood was almost hot, but what she took in her mouth was cool and sweet and refreshing. She could have drunk a good deal more, but some intuition told her to stop at two sips. Two was just the right number. She touched her lips and found that the swelling there was almost gone. She wasn't surprised. Not trying to be quiet, and not bothering to be grateful, at least not yet, Lisi floundered back to the beach. It seemed to take forever. No one was waiting near shore now, and the beach was empty. Lisi thought she saw the woman she'd spoken to sitting on one of the stone benches with her companion, but couldn't be sure because the moon hadn't risen quite enough. She looked a bit higher, and her gaze fixed on one of the rapt figures a dozen or so benches up from the water. Moonlight had coated one side of this creature's gauzy head with thin silver gilt, and a queer certainty came to her. That was Scott, and he was watching her. Didn't the idea make a kind of crazy sense? Didn't it? If he had held on to enough consciousness and will to come to her in the moments before dawn, as she lay in bed with her catatonic sister? Didn't it? If he was determined to have his say just one more time? She felt the urge to call his name, even though to do so would surely be dangerous madness. She opened her mouth, and water from her wet hair ran into her eyes, stinging them. Faintly, she heard the wind tinkling Chuck E. G.'s bell. It was then that Scott spoke to her, and for the last time. Lisi. Infinitely tender, that voice. Calling her name. Calling her home. Little. 15. Lisi, he says. Baby love. He's in the rocking chair, and she's sitting on the cold floor, but he's the one doing the shivering. Lisi has a sudden brilliant memory of Granny Dee saying, "Afeard and shivering in the dark." And it hits her that he's cold because now all of the African is in Buya Moon. But that's not all. The whole frigging room is cold. It was chilly before, but now it's cold, and the lights are out as well. The constant whooshy whisper of the furnace has ceased, and when she looks out of the frosty window, she can see only the extravagant colors of the northern lights. The Galloway's pole light next door has gone dark. Power outage, she thinks, but no, the television is still on, and that damned movie is still playing. The boys from Anarene, Texas are hanging out in the pool hall. Soon they'll go to Mexico, and when they come back, Sam the Lion will be dead. He'll be wrapped in gauze and sitting on one of those stone benches overlooking the... That's not right, Scott says. His teeth are chattering slightly, but she can still hear the perplexity in his voice. I never turned the goddamn movie on, because I thought it would wake you up, Lisi. Also, she knows that's true. When she came in here this time and found him, the TV was off. But right now, she's got something far more important on her mind. Scott, will it follow us? No, baby, he says. It can't do that unless it gets a real good whiff of your scent. Or a fix on your... He trails off. It's the movie he's still most concerned with, it seems. Also, it's never jambalaya in this scene. I've watched The Last Picture Show 50 times. Except for Citizen Kane, it may be the greatest movie ever made, and it's never jambalaya in the pool hall scene. It's Hank Williams, sure, but it's Kalijah, the song about the Indian chief. And if the TV and the VCR are working, where's the damn lights? He gets up and flicks the wall switch. There's nothing. That big cold wind from Yellowknife has finally killed their power. And power all over Castle Rock, Castle View, Harlow, Motton, Tashmore Pond, and most of western Maine. A At the same instant Scott flicks the useless light switch on, the TV goes off. The picture dwindles to a bright white spot that glows for a moment, then disappears. The next time he tries his tape of the last picture show, he'll discover a 10-minute stretch in the middle of it is blank, as if wiped clean by a powerful magnetic field. Neither of them will ever speak of it, but Scott and Lisi will understand that although both of them were visualizing the guest room, it was probably Lisi who hollered them home with the greatest force. And it was certainly Lisi who visualized old Hank singing Jambalaya instead of Kalijah. And it was Lisi who so fiercely visualized both the VCR and the TV running when they returned that those appliances did run for almost a minute and a half, even though the electricity was out from one end of Castle County to the other. He stokes up the wood stove in the kitchen with oak chunks from the wood box, and she makes them a jackleg bed, blankets and an air mattress, on the linoleum. When they lie down, he takes her in his arms. "I'm afraid to go to sleep," she confesses. "I'm afraid that when I wake up in the morning, the stove will be out and you'll be gone again." He shakes his head. "I'm all right. It's passed for a while." She looks at him with hope and doubt. "Is that something you know, or just something you're saying to soothe the little wife?" "Which do you think?" She thinks this isn't the ghost Scott she's been living with since November, but it's still hard for her to believe in such miraculous changes. "You seem better, but I'm leery of my own wishful thinking." In the stove, a knot of wood explodes and she jumps. He holds her closer. She snuggles against him almost fiercely. It's warm under the covers, warm in his arms. He is all she has ever wanted in the dark. He says, This thing that has troubled my family. It comes and goes. When it passes, it's like a cramp letting go. But will it come back? Lisi, it might not. The strength and surety in his voice so surprises her that she looks up to check his face. She sees no duplicity there, even of the kindly sort meant to ease a troubled wife's heart. And if it does, it might never come back as strongly as it did this time. "Did your father tell you that?" "My father didn't know much about the gone part. I've felt this tug toward the place where you found me twice before. Once the year before I met you. That time booze and rock music got me through. The second time, Germany," she says flatly. "Yes," he says, "Germany. That time you pulled me through, Lisi." "How close, Scott? How close was it in Bremen?" "Close," he says simply, and it makes her cold. If she had lost him in Germany, she would have lost him for good. Mein Gott. But that was a breeze compared to this. This was a hurricane. There are other things she wants to ask him, but mostly she wants to hold him and believe him when he says that maybe things will be okay. The way you want to believe the doctor, she supposes, when he says that the cancer is in remission and may never come back. "And you're okay." She needs to hear him say it one more time. Needs to. "Yes. Good to go, as the saying is." "And it?" She doesn't need to be more specific. Scott knows what she's talking about. "It's had my scent for a long time, and it knows the shape of my thoughts. After all these years, we're practically old friends. It could probably take me if it wanted to, but it would be an effort, and that fella's pretty lazy. Also, something watches out for me. Something on the bright side of the equation. There is a bright side, you know. You must know, because you're a part of it. Once you told me you could call it if you wanted to." She says this very low. "Yes. And sometimes you want to, don't you?" He doesn't deny it, and outside the wind howls a long, cold note along the eaves. Yet here under the blankets in front of the kitchen stove, it's warm. It's warm with him. "Stay with me, Scott," she says. "I will," he tells her.
I will, as long as... 16. I will as long as I can, Lisi said. She realized several things at the same time. One was that she had returned to her bedroom and her bed. Another was that the bed would have to be changed, because she had come back soaking wet and her damp feet were coated with beach sand from another world. A third was that she was shivering even though the room wasn't particularly cold. A fourth was that she no longer had the silver spade. She had left it behind. The last was that if the seated shape had indeed been her husband, she had almost certainly seen him for the last time. Her husband was now one of the shrouded things, an unburied corpse. Lying on her wet bed in her soaking shorts, Lisi burst into tears. She had a great deal to do now, and she had come back with most of the steps clear in her mind. She thought that might also have been part of her prize at the end of Scott's last bull hunt. But first, she needed to finish grieving for her husband. She put an arm over her eyes and lay so for the next 5 minutes, sobbing until her eyes were swollen nearly shut and her throat ached. She had never thought she would want him so much or miss him so badly. It was a shock. Yet at the same time, and although there was also still some pain in her damaged breast, Lisi thought she had never felt so well, so glad to be alive, or so ready to kick ass and take down names, as the saying was. Chapter 12. Lisi at Greenlawn. The Hollyhocks. 1. She glanced at the clock on the nightstand as she peeled off her soaked shorts and smiled, not because there was anything intrinsically funny about 10 minutes to 12 on a morning in June, but because one of Scrooge's lines from A Christmas Carol had occurred to her. The spirits have done it all in one night. It seemed to Lisi that something had accomplished a great deal in her own life in a very short period of time, most of it in the last few hours. But you have to remember that I've been living in the past, and that takes up a surprising amount of a person's time, she thought. And after a moment's consideration, let out a great, larruping laugh that probably would have sounded insane to anyone listening down the hall. That's okay. Keep laughing, baby love. Ain't nobody here but us chickadees, she thought, going into the bathroom. That big, loose laugh started to come out of her again, then stopped suddenly when it occurred to her that Dooley might be here. He could be holed up in the root cellar, or one of this big house's many closets. He might be sweating it out this late morning in the attic, right over her head. She didn't know much about him and would be the first to admit it, but the idea that he had gone to ground here in the house fit what she did know. He'd already proved he was a bold son of a bitch. Don't worry about him now. Worry about Darla and Canty. Good idea. Lisi could get to Greenlawn ahead of her older sisters. That wouldn't be much of a horse race. But she couldn't afford to dawdle either. Keep your string a-drawing, she thought. But she couldn't deny herself a moment in front of the full-length mirror on the back of her bedroom door, standing with her hands at her sides, looking levelly and without prejudice at her slender, unremarkable, middle-aged body, and at her face, which Scott had once described as that of a fox in summer. It was a little puffy, nothing more. She looked like she'd slept exceptionally hard, maybe after a drink or three too many, and her lips still turned out a little, giving them a strangely sensual quality that made her feel both uneasy and a tiny bit gleeful. She hesitated, not sure what to do about that, and then found a tube of Revlon Hothouse Pink at the back of her lipstick drawer. She touched some on and nodded a little doubtfully. If people were going to look at her lips, and she thought they might, she'd do better giving them something to look at than trying to cover up what couldn't be hidden. The breast Dooley had operated on with such lunatic absorption was marked with an ugly scarlet ditch that circled up from beneath her armpit before petering out above her ribcage. It looked like a fairly bad cut that might have happened 2 or 3 weeks ago and was now healing well.
The two shallower wounds looked like no more than the sort of red marks that resulted from wearing too tight elastic garments. Or perhaps, if you had a lively imagination, rope burns. The difference between this and the horror she had observed upon regaining consciousness was amazing. "All the Landons are fast healers, you son of a bitch," Lisi said, and stepped into the shower. 2. A quick rinse was all she had time for, and her breast was still sore enough to make her decide against a bra. She put on a pair of carpenter's pants and a loose t-shirt. She slipped a vest over the latter to keep anyone from staring at her nipples, assuming guys bothered scoping out the nipples of 50-year-old women, that was. According to Scott, they did. She remembered his telling her, once upon a happier time, that straight men stared at pretty much anyone of a female persuasion between the ages of roughly 14 and 84. He claimed it was a simple hardwired circuit between eye and cock, that the brain had nothing to do with it. It was noon. She went downstairs, glanced into the living room, and saw the remaining pack of cigarettes sitting on the coffee table. She had no craving for cigarettes now. She got a fresh jar of Skippy out of the pantry instead, steeling herself for Jim Dooley lurking in the corner or behind the pantry door, and the strawberry jam out of the fridge. She made herself a PB&J on white and took two delicious gummy bites before calling Professor Woodbody. The Castle County Sheriff's Department had taken Zach McCool's threatening letter, but Lisi's memory for numbers had always been good, and this one was a cinch. Pittsburgh area code at one end, 81 and 88 at the other. She was as willing to talk to the queen of the Inkunks as the king. An answering machine, however, would be inconvenient. She could leave her message, but would have no way of being sure it would reach the right ear in time to do any good. She need not have worried. Woodbody himself answered, and he did not sound kingly. He sounded chastened and cautious. "Yes, hello?" "Hello, Professor Woodbody. This is Lisa Landon. I don't want to talk to you. I've spoken to my lawyer, and he says I don't have to." "Chill," she said, and eyed her sandwich with longing. It wouldn't do to talk with her mouth full. On the upside, she thought this conversation was going to be brief. "I'm not going to make any trouble for you. No trouble with the cops, no trouble with lawyers, nothing like that. If you do me one teensy favor." "What favor?" Woodbody sounded suspicious. Lisi couldn't blame him for that. "There's an off chance your friend Jim Dooley may call you today."
"That guy's no friend of mine," Woodbody bleated.
"Right," Lisi thought, "and you're well on your way to persuading yourself he never was. Okay, drinking buddy, passing acquaintance, whatever. If he calls, just tell him I've changed my mind. Would you do that? Say I've regained my senses. Tell him I'll see him this evening at 8 in my husband's study." "You sound like someone preparing to get herself into a great deal of trouble, Mrs. Landon. Hey, you'd know, wouldn't you?" The sandwich was looking better and better. Lisi's stomach rumbled. "Professor, he probably won't call you, in which case you're golden. If he does call, give him my message and you're also golden. But if he calls and you don't give him my message, just, she's changed her mind, she wants to see you tonight in Scott's study at 8, and I find out, then, sir, oy, such a mess I'm making for you."
"You can't, my lawyer says—"
"Don't listen to what he says. Be smart, and listen to what I'm saying. My husband left me $20 million. With that kind of money, if I decide to ass fuck you, you'll spend the next 3 years shitting blood from a crouch. Got it?" Lisi hung up before he could say anything else, tore a bite from her sandwich, got the lime Kool-Aid from the fridge, thought about a glass, then drank directly from the pitcher instead. Yum. 3. If Dooley phoned during the next few hours, she wouldn't be around to take his call. Luckily, Lisi knew which phone he'd ring in on. She went out to her unfinished office in the barn, across from the shrouded corpse of the Bremen bed. She sat in the plain kitchen-style chair. A nice new desk chair was one of the things she'd never gotten around to ordering. Pushed the record message button on the answering machine and spoke without thinking too much. She hadn't come back from Booyah Moon with a plan so much as with a clear set of steps to follow, and the belief that, if she did her part, Jim Dooley would be forced to do his.
"I'll whistle and you'll come to me, my lad," she thought.
"Zack, Mr. Dooley, this is Lisi. If you're hearing this, I'm visiting my sister who's in the hospital up in Auburn. I spoke to the prof, and I'm so grateful this is going to work out. I'll be in my husband's study tonight at 8, or you can call me here at 7 and arrange something else if you're worried about the police. There may be a sheriff's deputy parked out front, maybe even in the bushes across the road, so be careful. I'll listen for messages." She was afraid that might be too much for the outgoing message tape to handle, but it wasn't. And what would Jim Dooley make of it if he called this number and heard it? Given his current level of craziness, Lisi couldn't begin to predict. Would he break radio silence and call the professor in Pittsburgh? He might. Whether or not the professor would actually pass on her message if Dooley did was also impossible to predict, and maybe it didn't matter. She didn't much care if Dooley thought she was actually ready to deal or just jacking him around. She only wanted him nervous and curious, the way she imagined a fish felt when it was looking up at a lure skipping along the surface of a lake. She didn't dare leave a note on her door. It was all too likely Deputy Beckman or Deputy Alston would read it long before Dooley had a chance to, and that was probably taking things a step too far anyway. For the time being, she had done all she could. "And do you really expect him to show up at 8 o'clock tonight, Lisi? To just come waltzing up the stairs to Scott's office full of trust and belief?" She didn't expect him to come waltzing, and she didn't expect him to be full of anything but the lunacy she had already experienced. But she did expect him to come. He would be as careful as any feral thing, casting about for a trap or a setup, possibly sneaking in from the woods as early as mid-afternoon, but Lisi believed he would know in his heart that this wasn't some trick that she'd worked out with the sheriff's department or the state police. He'd know from the eagerness to please he heard in her voice, and because after what he'd done to her, he had every reason to expect her to be one cowed cow. She played the message back twice and nodded. Yeah. On the surface, she sounded like a woman who was merely eager to finish some troublesome piece of business, but she thought Dooley would hear the fright and pain just beneath, because he expected to hear them, and because he was crazy. Lisi thought there was something else at work here as well. She had gotten her drink. She had gotten her bool, and it had made her strong in some primal way. It might not last long, but that didn't matter, because a little of that strength, a little of that primal weirdness, was now on the answering machine tape. She thought that if Dooley called, he would hear it and respond to it. 4. Her cell phone was still in the BMW, and now fully charged. She thought of going back to the little office in the barn and redoing the message on the answering machine, adding the mobile number, then realized she didn't know it. "I so rarely call myself darling," she thought, and unloosed that big, larruping laugh again. She drove slowly out to the end of the driveway, hoping that Deputy Alston would be there. He was, looking bigger than ever and rather primal himself. Lisi got out of her car and gave him a little salute. He did not call for backup or run screaming from the sight of her face. He merely grinned and tipped the salute right back at her. It had certainly crossed Lisi's mind to spin a tale if she found a deputy on duty. Something about Zack McCool calling her up and telling her he'd decided to get his little old self back to his little old holler in West Virginia and forget all about the writer's widder woman. Just too many Yankee police around. She'd do it without the Deliverance accent, of course, and she thought she could be fairly convincing, especially in her current state of baptismal grace. But in the end, she had decided against it. Such a story might end up putting acting Sheriff Clusterfuck and his deputies even more on their guard. They might think Jim Dooley was trying to lull them to sleep. No, much better to leave matters as they were. Dooley had found his way to her once. He could probably do it again. If they caught him, her problems would be solved. Although in truth, seeing Jim Dooley caught was no longer her solution of choice. In any case, she didn't like the idea of lying to either Alston or Beckman any more than she had to.
They were cops. They were doing their best to protect her. And on top of that, they were a couple of likable lummoxes.
How's it going, Mrs. Landon?
Fine. I just stopped to tell you I'm going up to Auburn. My sister's in the hospital up there.
I'm very sorry to hear that. CMG or Kingdom?
Greenlawn. She wasn't sure he'd know it, but from the little wince that tightened his face, she guessed that he did.
Well, that's too bad. But at least it's a pretty day for a drive. You just want to get back before late afternoon. Radio says there's going to be big thunderstorms, especially here in the Western.
Lisi looked around and smiled, first at the day, which was indeed summery gorgeous, at least so far, and then at Deputy Alston. I'll do my best. Thanks for the heads up.
Not a problem.
Say, the side of your nose looks kind of swelled. Did something bite you?
Mosquitoes do that to me sometimes, Lisi said. There's one beside my lip, too. Can you see it? Alston peered at her mouth, which Dooley had beaten back and forth with his open hand not long ago.
Nope. Can't say that I do.
Good, the Benadryl must be working, as long as it doesn't make me sleepy.
If it does, pull over, okay? Do yourself a favor.
Yes, Dad, Lisi said, and Alston laughed. He also blushed a little.
By the way, Mrs. Landon?
Lisi.
Yes, ma'am, Lisi. Andy called. He'd like you to drop by the sheriff's office when it's convenient and make an official report on this business. You know, something you can sign for the record. Would you do that?
Yes, I'll try to stop in on my way back from Auburn.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret, Mrs. Lisi. Both our secretaries are apt to clear out early on days when it comes on to hard rain. They live out in Mountain Way, and those roads flood if you look at them cross-eyed. Need new culverts.
Lisi shrugged. We'll see, she said. She made a show of looking at her watch. Whoa, look at the time. I really have to run. Help yourself to the toilet if you have to, Deputy Alston. There's...
Joe. If you're Lisi, I'm Joe.
She gave him a thumbs up.
Okay, Joe. There's a key to the back door under the porch step. If you feel around a little, I think you'll find it. Yeah, I'm a trained investigator, he said with a straight face.
Lisi burst out laughing and held up her hand. Deputy Joe Alston, now grinning himself, high-fived her there in the sunshine near the mailbox where she'd found the dead Galloway barn cat. 5. Driving to Auburn, she mused for a little while on how Deputy Joe Alston had looked at her as they stood talking at the end of the driveway. It had been a long while since she'd attracted a honey-you-look-so-good stare from a man, but she'd gotten one today, slightly swollen nose and all. Amazing. Amazing. The get beat up by Jim Dooley beauty treatment, she said and laughed. I could hawk it on high-channel cable TV. And her mouth had the most wonderfully sweet taste. If she ever wanted another cigarette, she would be surprised. Maybe she could hawk that on high-channel cable, too. 6. By the time Lisi got to Greenlawn, it was 1:20. She didn't expect to see Darla's car, but still let out a sigh of relief when she had made sure it wasn't one of the dozen or so scattered around the visitor's parking lot. She liked the idea of Darla and Canty well south of here, well away from the dangerous craziness of Jim Dooley. She remembered helping Mr. Silver grade potatoes when she was a little girl, well, 12 or 13, not so little at that, and how he'd always cautioned her to wear pants and keep her sleeves rolled up when she was around the potato grater in the back shed.
You get caught in that baby, she'll undress you, he'd said,
and she had taken the warning to heart, because she understood old Max Silver hadn't been talking about what his hulk of a potato grater would do to her clothes, but what it would do to her. Amanda was part of this, had been since the day she'd shown up as Lisi was half-heartedly beginning the job of cleaning out Scott's study. Lisi accepted that. Darla and Canty, however, would be an unnecessary complication. If God was good, he would keep them at the snow squall, eating lazy lobster and drinking white wine spritzers for a long time. Like until midnight.
Before she got out of her car, Lisi touched her left breast lightly with her right hand, wincing in advance at the bright lance of pain she expected. All she felt was a faint throb. Amazing, she thought. It's like touching a week-old bruise. Anytime you get to doubting the reality of Booyah Moon, Lisi, just remember what he did to your breast, not even 5 hours ago, and what it feels like now. She got out of the car, locked it with the smart key, then paused for a moment to look around, trying to fix the spot in her mind. She had no clear reason for doing this. Nothing she could have put her finger on, even if she'd wanted to. It was just more of that step-by-step thing, almost like baking bread for the first time from a cookbook recipe, and that was fine by her. Freshly tarred and lined, the Green Lawn Visitor's parking lot reminded her strongly of the parking lot where her husband had fallen 18 years ago, and she heard the ghostly voice of Assistant Professor Roger Dashmeal, a.k.a. the Southern Fried Chicken Shit, saying,
"We'll proceed on across yonder parking lot to Nelson Hall, which is mercifully air-conditioned."
No Nelson Hall here. Nelson Hall was in the land of ago, as was the man who had gone there to dig a spadeful of earth and inaugurate construction of the Shipman Library. What she saw looming over the neatly trimmed hedges wasn't an English department building, but the smooth brick and bright glass of a 21st-century madhouse, the sort of clean, well-lighted place where her husband might well have finished up if something, some spore the doctors in Bowling Green had eventually elected to call pneumonia. No one wanted to put unknown causes on the death certificate of a man whose demise would be reported on the front page of the New York Times. Had not finished him first. On this side of the hedge was an oak tree. Lisi had parked so that the BMW would be in its shade, although, yes, she could see clouds massing in the west, so maybe Deputy Joe Alston was right about those afternoon thunderstorms. The tree would make a perfectly lovely marker if it had been the only one, but it wasn't. There was a whole row of them along the hedge. To Lisi, they all looked the same. And what the smuck did it matter anyway? She started for the path to the main building, but something inside, a voice that didn't seem like any of the variations of her own mental voice, nagged her back, insisting that she look at her car and its place in the parking lot again. She wondered if something wanted her to move the BMW to a different spot. If so, it wasn't making its wants known very clearly. Lisi settled for a walk around instead, as her father had told her you should always do before setting out on a long trip. Only then you were looking for uneven tire wear, a busted taillight, a sagging muffler, things of that sort. Now she didn't know what she was looking for. Maybe I'm just putting off seeing her. Maybe that's all it is. But it wasn't. It was more. And it was important. She observed her license plate, 576-1RD, with that stupid loon, and a very faded bumper sticker, a joke gift from Jody. It read, "Jesus loves me, this I know, that is why I don't drive slow." Nothing else. Not good enough, the voice nagged, and then she spied something interesting in the far corner of the parking lot, almost beneath the hedge. An empty green bottle. A beer bottle, she was almost sure. Either the maintenance crew had missed it or hadn't gotten to it yet. Lisi hurried over and picked it up, getting a certain sour agricultural whiff from the neck of the thing. On the label, slightly faded, was a snarling canine. According to the label, this bottle had once held Nordic Wolf Premium Beer. Lisi brought the bottle back to her car and set it on the pavement directly beneath the loon on her license plate. Cream-colored BMW, not good enough. Cream-colored BMW sitting in the shadow of an oak tree, still not good enough. Cream-colored BMW sitting in the shadow of an oak tree with an empty Nordic Wolf beer bottle under main loon license plate 576-1RD and slightly to the left of the joke bumper sticker. Good enough. Just barely. And why? Lisi didn't give a sweet smuck. She hurried for the main building. 7. There was no trouble getting in to see Amanda, even though afternoon visiting hours did not officially commence until 2, which was still half an hour away.
Thanks to Dr. Hugh Albernez and Scott, of course, Lisi was something of a star at Greenlawn. 10 minutes after giving her name at the main desk, dwarfed by a gigantic new-agey mural of children with linked hands staring raptly up into the night sky, Lisi was sitting with her sister on the little patio outside Amanda's room, sipping lackluster punch from a Dixie cup, and watching a game of croquet on the rolling back lawn for which the place had no doubt been named. Somewhere out of sight, a power mower blatted monotonously. The duty nurse had asked Amanda if she wouldn't also like a cup of bug juice, and took Amanda's silence for consent. It now sat untouched beside her on the table while Amanda, dressed in a mint-green pajama set and with a matching ribbon in her freshly washed hair, looked blankly off into the distance, not at the croquet players, Lisi thought, but through them. Her hands were clasped in her lap, but Lisi could see the ugly cut that looped around the left one, and the gleam of fresh salve. Lisi had tried 3 different conversation openers, and Amanda had not uttered so much as a single word in response, which, according to the nurse, was par for the course. Amanda was currently incommunicado, not taking messages, out to lunch, on vacation, visiting the asteroid belt. All her life she had been troublesome, but this was a new high even for her. And Lisi, who was expecting company in her husband's study only 6 hours from now, didn't have time for it. She took a sip of her largely flavorless drink, wished for a Coke, verboten here because of the caffeine, and set it aside. She looked around to make sure they were alone, then leaned forward and plucked Amanda's hands out of her lap, trying not to wince at the slimy feel of the salve and the lumpy lines of the healing slashes just beneath. If it hurt Amanda to be held so, she didn't show it. Her face remained a smooth blank, as if she were sleeping with her eyes open. "Amanda," Lisi said. She tried to make eye contact with her sister, but it was impossible. "Amanda, listen to me now. You wanted to help me clean up what Scott left behind, and I need you to help me do that. I need your help." No answer. "There's a bad man, a crazy man. He's a little like that son of a bitch Cole in Nashville, a lot like him, actually. Only I can't take care of this one on my own. You have to come back from wherever you are and help me." No answer. Amanda stared out at the croquet players, through the croquet players. The power mower blatted. The paper cups of bug juice sat on the patio table that had no corners. In this place, corners were as verboten as caffeine. "Do you know what I think, Manda Bunny? I think you're sitting on one of those stone benches with the rest of the gorked-out goners, staring at the pool. I think Scott saw you there on one of his visits and said to himself, 'Oh, a cutter. I recognize cutters when I see him because my dad was a member of the tribe. Hell, I'm a member of the tribe.' He said to himself, 'There's a lady who's going to take early retirement here unless somebody puts a spoke in her wheel, so to speak.' Does that sound about right, Manda?" "Nothing. I don't know if he foresaw Jim Dooley, but he foresaw you ending up at Greenlawn, just as sure as shite sticks to a blanket. Do you remember how Dandy used to say that sometimes, Manda? Just as sure as shite sticks to a blanket? And when Good Ma yelled at him, he said shite was like drat, shite wasn't swearing, do you remember?" More nothing from Amanda, just a vacant, maddening gape. Lisi thought of that cold night with Scott in the guest room, when the wind thundered and the sky burned, and put her mouth close to Amanda's ear. "If you can hear me, squeeze my hands," she whispered. "Squeeze just as hard as you can." She waited, and the seconds passed. She had almost given up when there came the faintest twitch. It could have been an involuntary muscle spasm or just imagination, but Lisi didn't think so. She thought that somewhere far away, Amanda heard her sister hollering her name, hollering her home. "All right," Lisi said. Her heart was pounding so hard she felt it might choke her. "That's good. That's a start. I'm going to come get you, Amanda. I'm going to bring you home, and you're going to help me. Do you hear? You have to help me." Lisi closed her eyes and once more tightened her grip on Amanda's hands, knowing she might be hurting her sister, not caring. Amanda could complain later when she had a voice to complain with, if she had a voice to complain with. Ah, but the world was made of if, Scott had told her that once. Lisi summoned her will and concentration and created the clearest version of the pool she could, seeing the rocky cup in which it lay, seeing the clean white arrowhead of beach with the stone benches stepped above it in mild curves, seeing the break in the rock and the secondary path, something like a throat that led to the graveyard. She made the water a brilliant blue, sparkling with thousands of sun points. She made it the pool at midday, because she'd had her fill of Buya Moon at dusk, thank you very much. Now, she thought, and waited for the air to turn and the sounds of Greenlawn to fade. For a moment she thought those sounds did fade, then decided that really was her imagination. She opened her eyes and the patio was still ratcheer, with Amanda's cup of bug juice on the round table. Amanda remained in her deep catatonic placidity, so much breathing wax within her mint-green pajamas, which closed with Velcro because buttons could be swallowed. Amanda with the matching green ribbon in her hair and the oceans in her eyes. For a moment, Lisi was assailed with terrible doubt. Perhaps the whole thing had been nothing but her madness, all except for Jim Dooley, that was. There were no screwed-up families like the Landons outside of V.C. Andrews' novels. No places like Buya Moon outside of children's fantasy tales. She had been married to a writer who died, that was all. She had saved him once, but when he got sick in Kentucky 8 years later, there had been nothing she could do. Because you couldn't swat a microbe with a shovel, could you? She began to relax her hold on Amanda's hands, then tightened it again. Every bit of her strong heart and considerable will rose up in protest. No, it was real. Buya Moon is real. I was there in 1979 before I married him. I went there again in 1996 to find him when he needed finding, to bring him home when he needed bringing, and I was there again this morning. All I have to do is compare how my breast felt after Jim Dooley finished with it to what it feels like now, if I start to doubt. The reason I can't go... The African, she murmured. He said the African was holding us there like an anchor. He didn't know why. Are you holding us here, Manda? Is some scared, stubborn part of you holding us here? Holding me here? Amanda didn't answer, but Lisi thought that was exactly what was happening. Part of Amanda wanted Lisi to come get her and bring her back, but there was another part that wanted no rescue. That part really did want to be done with all the dirty world and the dirty world's problems. That part would be more than happy to continue taking lunch through a tube and shooting poop into a diaper and spending warm afternoons out here on the little patio, wearing pajamas with Velcro closures, staring at the green lawns and the croquet players. And what was Amanda really looking at? The pool. The pool in the morning, the pool in the afternoon, the pool at sunset and glimmering by starshine and moonlight, with little trails of vapor rising from its surface like dreams of amnesia. Lisi realized her mouth still tasted sweet, as it usually did only first thing in the morning, and thought, that's from the pool. My prize. My drink. Two sips. One for me, and one... One for you, she said. All at once, the next step was so beautifully clear that she wondered why she had wasted so much time. Still holding Amanda by the hands, Lisi leaned forward so that her face was in front of her sister's. Amanda's eyes remained unfocused and far-seeing beneath her straight-cut, graying bangs, as if she were looking right through Lisi. Only when Lisi slid her arms up to Amanda's elbows, first pinning her in place and then putting her mouth against her sister's mouth, did Amanda's eyes widen in belated understanding. Only then did Amanda struggle, and by then it was too late. Lisi's mouth flooded with sweetness as her last sip from the pool reversed itself. She used her tongue to force Amanda's lips open, and as she felt the second mouthful of water she had drunk from the pool flow from her mouth to her sister's, Lisi saw the pool with a perfect daytime clarity that beggared her previous efforts at concentration and visualization, fierce and driven though they had been. She could smell frangipani and bougainvillea, mingled with the deep and somehow sorrowful olive smell that she knew was the daytime aroma of the sweetheart trees. She could feel the packed hot sand beneath her feet, her bare feet, because her sneakers hadn't traveled. Her sneakers hadn't, but she had. She had made it. She had gotten over. She was... 8. She was back in Buya Moon, standing on the warm, packed sand of the beach, this time with the bright sun beating down overhead and making not thousands of points of light on the water, but what seemed like millions. Because this water was whiter. For a moment, Lisi looked at it, fascinated, and at the great old hulk of a sailing ship that floated there. And as she looked at it, she suddenly understood something the revenant in Amanda's bed had told her. "What's my prize?" Lisi had asked, and the thing, which had somehow seemed to be both Scott and Amanda at the same time, had told her that her prize would be a drink. But when Lisi asked if that meant a Coke or an RC, the thing had said, "Be quiet. We want to watch the hollyhocks." Lisi had assumed the thing was talking about flowers. She had forgotten that there had been a very different meaning for that word once upon a time, a magical one. That ship out there in all that blue and shining water was what Amanda had meant. For that had been Amanda. Scott would almost surely not have known about that wonderful childhood dreamboat. This was no pool she was looking at. This was a harbor where only one ship rode at anchor, a ship made for brave pirate girls who dared to go seeking treasure and boyfriends. And their captain? Why, the brave Amanda de Buscher, to be sure, for once upon a time, had not yonder sailing ship been Amanda's happiest fantasy? Once upon a time, before she had become so outwardly angry and so inwardly afraid? "Be quiet. We want to watch the hollyhocks." "Oh, Amanda," Lisi thought, almost mourned. "This was the pool where we all came down to drink, the very cup of imagination, and so, of course, everyone saw it a little bit differently. This childhood refuge was Amanda's version. The benches were the same, however, which led Lisi to surmise that they, at least, were bedrock reality. Today she saw 20 or 30 people sitting on them, looking dreamily out at the water, and roughly the same number of shrouded forms. In daylight, these latter bore a sickening resemblance to insects wrapped in silk by great spiders. She quickly spied Amanda, a dozen or so benches up. Lisi skirted two of the silent gazers and one of the scary shrouded things in order to reach her. She sat down beside her and once more took Amanda's hands, which weren't cut or even scarred over here. And, as Lisi held them, Amanda's fingers closed very slowly but definitely upon hers. A queer certainty came to Lisi then. Amanda didn't need the other sip from the pool Lisi had taken, nor did she need Lisi to coax her down to the water for a healing dip. Amanda did indeed want to come home. A large part of her had been waiting to be rescued, like a sleeping princess in a fairy tale, or a brave pirate girl cast into Durance Vile. And how many of these other unshrouded ones might be in the same situation? Lisi saw their outwardly calm faces and distant eyes, but that didn't mean some of them weren't screaming on the inside for someone to help them find their way back home. Lisi, who could only help her sister, maybe, shuddered away from this idea. "Amanda," she said, "we're going back now, but you have to help." Nothing at first, then very faint, very low, as if spoken out of sleep. "Lisi, did you drink that shitty punch?" Lisi laughed in spite of herself. "A little, to be polite. Now look at me." "I can't. I'm watching the hollyhocks. I'm going to be a pirate and sail." Her voice was fading now. "The seven seas. Treasure. The Cannibal Isles." That was make-believe, Lisi said. She hated the harshness she heard in her own voice. It was a little like drawing a sword to kill an infant that lay placidly on the grass, hurting no one. Because wasn't that what a childhood dream was like? What you see is just this place's way of catching you. It's just a bool. Surprising her and hurting her, Manda said.
Scott told me you'd try to come. That if I ever needed you, you'd try to come.
When, Manda? When did he tell you that?
He loved it here, Amanda said, and fetched a deep sigh. He called it Bulya Mood or something like that. He said it was easy to love, too easy.
When, Manda, when did he say that?
Lisi wanted to shake her. Amanda appeared to make a tremendous effort and smiled.
The last time I cut myself. Scott made me come home. He said, you all wanted me.
Now so much seemed clear to Lisi. Too late to make any difference, of course, but it was still better to know.
And why had he never told his wife?
Because he knew that little Lisi was terrified of Bulya Moon and the things, one thing in particular, that lived here?
Yes.
Because he sensed she would find out in time for herself?
Again, yes.
Amanda had once more turned her attention to the ship floating in the harbor that was her version of Scott's pool. Lisi shook her shoulder. I need you to help me, Manda. There's a lunatic who wants to hurt me, and I need you to help me put a spoke in his wheel. I need you to help me now. Amanda turned to look at Lisi with an almost comical expression of wonder on her face. Below them, a woman wearing a caftan and holding a snapshot of a smiling, gap-toothed child in one hand, looked back and spoke in slow, drifting remonstrance.
Be quiet while I think of why I did it.
Mind your beeswax, Betty, Lisi told her briskly, and then turned back to Amanda. She was relieved to see Amanda was still looking at her.
Lisi, who?
A crazy man, one who showed up because of Scott's damned papers and manuscripts. Only now what he's interested in is me. He hurt me this morning, and he'll hurt me again if we don't. Amanda was turning once more toward the ship riding at anchor in the harbor, and Lisi took her head firmly in her hands so they were looking at each other again. Pay attention, Beanpole.
Don't call me Bean.
Pay attention and I won't. You know my car, my BMW?
Yes, but Lisi.
Amanda's eyes were still trying to drift back toward the water. Lisi almost turned her head back again, but some instinct told her that was a quick fix at best. If she really meant to get Amanda out of here, she had to do it with her voice, with her will, and ultimately because Amanda wanted to come.
Manda, this guy. Never mind just hurting. If you don't help me, I think there's a chance he might kill me.
Now Amanda looked at her with amazement and perplexity.
Kill?
Yes, yes. I promise I'll explain everything, but not here. If we stay here long, I'll end up doing nothing but gawking at the hollyhocks with you.
Nor did she think this was a lie. She could feel the pull of the thing, how it wanted her to look. If she gave in, 20 years might pass like 20 minutes. At the end of them, she and Big Sis Amanda Bunny would still be sitting here, waiting to board a pirate ship that always beckoned but never sailed.
Will I have to drink any of that shitty punch? Any of that?
Amanda's brow furrowed as she struggled for memory, then the lines smoothed out.
Any of that bug juice?
The childish way she drew out the word surprised Lisi into another laugh, and once more the woman wearing the caftan and holding the photograph looked around. Amanda gladdened Lisi's heart by giving the woman a haughty, "Who you looking at, bitch?" stare, and then flipping her the bird.
Will I, little Lisi?
No more punch, no more bug juice, I promise. For now, you just think of my car. Do you know the color? Are you sure you remember?
Cream.
Amanda's lips thinned a little, and her look took on its just a little home truth whenever you like it or not expression.
Lisi was absolutely delighted to see it.
I told you when you bought it that no color shows the dirt quicker, but you wouldn't listen.
Do you remember the bumper sticker?
A joke about Jesus, I think. Sooner or later, some pissed-off Christian is going to key it off, and probably put a few scratches in your finish for good luck.
From above them came a man's voice, heavily disapproving.
If you need to talk, you should go. Somewhere else.
Lisi didn't even bother turning around, let alone shooting him at the bird.
The sticker says, Jesus loves me, this I know, that is why I don't drive slow.
I want you to close your eyes now, Amanda, and see my car. See it from the back, so the bumper sticker's showing. See it in the shade of a tree. The shade's moving because it's breezy. Can you do that?
Yes, I think so.
Her eyes cut sideways, taking one final longing glance at the ship in the harbor.
I guess so, if it will keep someone from hurting you. Although I don't see what it can have to do with Scott. He's been dead over 2 years now. Although, I think he told me something about Goodma's yellow Afghan, and I think he wanted me to tell you. Of course, I never did. I forgot so much about those times. On purpose, I suppose.
What times? What times, Amanda? Amanda looked at Lisi as though her baby sister were the stupidest thing going.
All the times I cut myself. After the last time, when I cut my belly button, we were here.
Amanda put a finger to her cheek, creating a temporary dimple.
It was something about a story. Your story. Lisi's story. And the Afghan. Only he called it the African. Did he say it was a boop? A beep? A boon? Maybe I only dreamed it.
This, coming so unexpectedly out of left field, jolted Lisi but did not derail her. If she was going to get Amanda out of here, and herself, it had to be now. Never mind all that, Amanda. Just close your eyes and see my car. Every damn detail you can manage. I'll do the rest. I hope, she thought. And when she saw Amanda close her eyes, she did the same and gripped her sister's hands tightly. Now she knew why she'd needed to see her car so clearly, so they could return to the visitor's parking lot rather than to Amanda's room in what was your basic locked ward. She saw her cream BMW, and Amanda was right, that color had been a disaster, then left that part to her sister. She concentrated on adding 5761RD to the license plate and the piece de resistance, that Nordic Wolf beer bottle, standing on the asphalt just a bit to the left of the Jesus Loves Me, This I Know bumper sticker. To Lisi, it looked perfect, and yet there was no change in the uniquely perfumed air of this place, and she could still hear a faint rippling sound that she realized must be slack canvas in a slight breeze. There was still the feel of the cool stone bench beneath her, and she felt a touch of panic. What if this time I can't get back? Then, from what seemed to be a great distance, she heard Amanda murmur in a tone of perfect exasperation.
Oh, booger, I forgot the fucking loon on the license plate.
A moment later, the rippling thwack of canvas first merged with the blat of the power mower, then disappeared. Only now the sound of the mower was distant because